You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the September 9th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. On my last program, I overlooked an important anniversary happening that day, as did most of the media. Wednesday, August 26th, marked 1 year since the end of Israel's most recent assault on the people of Gaza, whose lives and fortunes it has controlled since taking over the coastal strip of Palestine from Egypt in the 1967 war. The Israelis labeled a 51-day operation Protective Edge, and before it was over, more than 2,100 Palestinians would be killed, most of them women and children, and more than 11,000 wounded. By contrast, 73 Israelis died, 67 of whom were soldiers. The remaining six included one child. It was not a war, but a massacre carried out by the world's fifth or sixth most powerful military, armed and supported to the teeth by the United States against a largely defenseless population that had no place to hide. It was the fourth time since 2006 that Israel had conducted what might be called a deadly military exercise against the people of Gaza, which some Israeli military officials had come to describe as, quote, mowing the grass, end quote. As I saw for myself during Israel's occupation of Lebanon in 1983 and on past visits to the West Bank and Gaza, there is no shortage of sadists in the Israel Defense Forces. Last year's assault was the third time in the first 6 years of Barack Obama's presidency that Israel has mowed the grass of Gaza, but this episode was the most deadly and destructive yet. Apart from the dead and the wounded, the physical destruction was immense, with 18,000 homes being either completely or partially destroyed, while whole sections of villages were leveled and nearly 500,000 displaced. Other than compensating the UN for destruction of its buildings in Gaza, Israel has not been required to pay a single shekel for reparations or repairs. Since Israel controls the flow of construction materials into the besieged strip, there is not much difference in how it looks today than it did on the last day of the assault. During Israel's bombardment, the hospitals were under tremendous pressure to treat the wounded under the most difficult of conditions. One of the doctors attempting to do so, even as Israel made in the USA bombs were falling all around them, was a Norwegian physician, Mads Gilbert, who has long been devoted to the people of Gaza, people of Palestine, and their efforts to survive under Israel's siege. Dr. Gilbert has just published a powerful book about his experiences working in Gaza's Al-Shifa Hospital during the 15-day period in last year's bloody summer. He is called The Night in Gaza, and at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking to him about it at his home in Norway. A moment ago, I mentioned that the weapons employed by the Israelis in Gaza were made in America. It is what separates Israel's war on its 1.8 million residents from the carnage occurring in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, and other parts throughout the world. But it's not just the bomb. With the exception of the Merkava tanks, which it manufactures, and its drones, virtually every lethal weapon used by the Israeli military against Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, or Lebanon is manufactured in the United States and presented to the Israelis as a gift of the White House, the Pentagon, and the Israeli-occupied U.S. Congress. It is U.S. taxpayers who foot the bill, of course, but are kept in the dark about the details by a media that has gotten used to censoring what Israel's powerful friends in America do not want to see published. I refer to the M-16 assault rifles and the ammunition they use, the Apache helicopters and the Hellfire missiles that make them so deadly, and to the F-16 fighter jets and the bombs and rockets beneath their wings, against which the Palestinians have, at best, a few RPGs or rocket-propelled grenades. On top of that, the U.S. maintains a weapons storage depot in Israel that you may have not heard about. It was placed there for use by American forces in the region by George Bush Sr. in the run-up to the first U.S.-Iraq war. As a sop for staying out of that war and jeopardizing the president's Arab coalition, provisions were made for Israel to make use of those weapons as needed, again at no cost, even though there's no record that they replace what they use, which is supposed to be part of the agreement. Moreover, this past May, as I reported on Takes of the World at the time, and you heard nowhere else, President Obama authorized the Pentagon to provide Israel with an additional $1.9 billion in U.S. weaponry on top of the $3.1 billion it had already received, making it a cool $5 billion. The U.S. government, it should be noted, classifies these billion-dollar gifts to Israel as quote-unquote sales, another sign of the duplicity and amorality that shrouds the relations between the two countries. Washington gives Israel its $3.1 billion appropriation in cash, and Israel is required to spend three-quarters of it in the U.S. purchasing American-made weaponry. News of the additional $1.9 billion was widely reported in the Israeli press, but not in any domestic media outside of some Jewish community weeklies, which portrayed it as an effort to get Netanyahu to tone down his opposition to the Iran nuclear deal. If that was the case, it obviously didn't work. Since the U.S. mainstream media still has yet to carry the story, for reasons I will let you speculate, I'll repeat what the Times of Israel reported on May 20th. Quote, Israel will receive a supply of precision-guided munitions consisting of 750 bunker buster bombs, 3,000 Hellfire missiles, 250 medium-range air-to-air missiles, and 4,100 glide bombs in a deal worth $1.9 billion. In addition, the package includes 14,500 missile guidance systems known as tail kits for joint direction action munitions, which convert unguided bombs into GPS-guided missiles. To be sure, those bunker busters are not sufficient to penetrate Iran's deepest nuclear facilities, but they would cause considerable damage in either Gaza or Lebanon. This is something to think about when you hear or read reports that the Obama administration has defeated the Israel lobby, most notably AIPAC, over its opposition to the Iran nuclear deal. It is AIPAC that drew up the sanctions that have long been in place against Iran, and we may presume that it is AIPAC that is drawing up new ones that Israel's agents in the Senate are planning to introduce and get passed however Congress votes on the agreement with Iran. According to the National Iranian American Council, the opposition is already hard at work on its Plan B. Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, who has come out against the deal, is now working with other Democrats, including some of the 41 who are reluctantly supporting it, to put together new legislation to undermine the agreement's implementation. Cardin and New Jersey's Robert Menendez, the first Senate Democrat to publicly oppose the agreement, are both on the advisory board of the Israel Project, a hardline pro-Israel organization that propagandizes the American media. That more than two dozen members of Congress serve on the advisory board of the Israel Project should warrant an investigation by the Department of Justice's Foreign Agents Registry Department. But like everything else, when it comes to Israel, ordinary standards do not apply. In any case, opponents of the deal show no signs of giving up. AIPAC alone has already spent $40 million to try to kill it, and it's clear that it's going to continue along that path with the aim of dismantling the deal after President Obama leaves office. Today in Washington, Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz will be holding a rally against the Iran nuclear deal with rival Donald Trump as the guest star. That's the tip of the iceberg of campaigning and fundraising to thwart the deal by nonprofits funded partly by casino billionaire Sheldon Adelson, other right-wing groups, and fellow GOP candidates such as Marco Rubio, according to the Guardian of London. Congress technically has until September 17th to approve or disapprove the deal. That it will be disapproved is a certainty, but not by a big enough margin to overcome President Obama's promised veto. Another issue, however, may get in the way of the vote even happening. Bill Kristol, co-founder of the Project for New American Century, the Israel front group that lobbied for the war in Iraq, and who now, among other things, is the head of the Emergency Committee for Israel, is charging that the Obama administration has not lived up to the terms of its agreement with Congress. Kristol asserts that Obama has broken his promise to provide Congress with all the non-public side agreements made with Iran, including a private one between Iran and an international atomic energy agency governing its inspections. Since he hasn't, writes Kristol, not only should Congress not vote on the agreement in the next week or so, it should take the president to court if he is not willing to turn the text of the side agreements over to the deal's critics. That very well, may happen, so stay tuned. From another corner of Washington's pro-Israel network, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, or JINSA, the 41-year-old neocon operation that Colin Powell blamed for the Iraq War, two former generals have been selected to head JINSA, calls the Iran Strategic Council. Writing a critique of the Iran deal yesterday, General Retired James Conway, former Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Retired Charles Wald, former Deputy Commander of the United States European Command, note that, quote, the President has made clear that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, that's the official name of the agreement, does not preclude the need for robust military capabilities. And they quote Obama, quote, if 15 or 20 years from now, they write, quoting the president, Iran tries to build a bomb, this deal ensures the United States will have, if necessary, military options. And yet, our generals attest, even as the agreement boosts Iran's ability to meddle in the region and strains longstanding alliances, sequestration is already diminishing the U.S. military's ability to project power in the Middle East. They go on to say, quote, the U.S. military will still rise to face any future challenge, but it will do so with less manpower, fewer capabilities, more antiquated platforms, and a lower level of readiness than it has now or has had in a very long time. For all these reasons, they ominously conclude, the United States is in far better position to prevent a nuclear Iran today, even by military means, if necessary, than when the JCPOA sunsets. Protecting our national interest and our allies will require putting in place a strategy to begin mitigating the deal's downsides now, end quote. Generals Conway and Wald, I've reread those last two paragraphs several times, and it seems apparent to me these two former generals are calling for the U.S. to launch a war against Iran now, and given the organization sponsoring them, JINSA, it would be on Israel's behalf. This morning, I found out the two former generals presented their arguments and testimony before the House Foreign Relations Committee. And while on the subject of nuclear weapons in Israel, the assertion made by Grant Smith, director of IRMEP, Institute for Research, Middle East Policy, and a frequent guest on Takes on the World, that during the administration of Lyndon Johnson, an excessive amount of enriched uranium was diverted to Israel by NUMEC, a Pennsylvania-based government contractor, has been confirmed by documents just released by the CIA following a suit brought against the agency by Smith. What is not clear from the highly redacted documents is what role the CIA had played. Many of the 130 file memos record CIA briefings in the late 1970s to members of Congress inquiring whether the diversion was a covert CIA operation. Arizona Democrat Mars Udall asked bluntly on August 23, 1977, he asked, quote, is it possible that President Johnson, who was known to be a friend of Israel, could have encouraged the flow of nuclear materials to the Israelis? Associate Director for Operations Theodore Shackley and Deputy Director for Science and Technology Carl Duckett for the CIA deny the CIA played any role. They noted it was CIA Director Richard Helms who first alerted the Justice Department requesting in 1968 that the FBI conduct a discreet intelligence investigation into NUMEX President Shapiro's activities. The FBI investigation documented Shapiro's many meetings with Avraham Hermoni, director of Israel's nuclear weapons program, and Shapiro's invitation to top covert operative Rafi Atan, who later ran the Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard, to visit NUMEC facilities in 1968. The now-defunct Atomic Energy Commission successfully organized the transfer of NUMEC's ownership to another contractor. In 1981, special agents finally interviewed a former NUMEC employee who had witnessed the diversion, how Zalman Shapiro and other NUMEC officials stuffed highly enriched uranium canisters into irradiators that were rushed to Israel. Lacking that missing piece of the puzzle, the FBI investigation went dormant as the statute of limitations for Atomic Energy Act violations expired. Today, the raised NUMEC facility near Apollo, Pennsylvania, is a Superfund site. Estimated cost to carry out the toxic waste cleanup over the next decade is between $350 and $500 million, according to U.S. Army Corps of Engineer estimate. CIA Station Chief John Hayden, who's in Tel Aviv, whose findings are redacted from the new release, had publicly characterized NUMEC as, quote, an Israeli operation from the beginning, end quote. Grant Smith, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, are planning further court actions to obtain full release of CIA operation files that would allow Apollo residents to sue the Israeli government directly for cleanup costs and massive health-related damages caused by the Israeli smuggling front, or have the funds deducted from Israel's annual $3.5 billion package of foreign aid. I was going to go on to tell you for years the U.S. government has been in denial about Israel's possession of nuclear weapons, but now the State Department has released documents that show that they have known about it and discussed Israel's possession of these weapons going back to 1969, but they have left the discussion out of the public arena, and they believed at the time that even if Israel would sign the nonproliferation agreement, they wouldn't live up to it.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is produced by Despina Moutsouris. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with Academy Award-winning actress Natalie Portman, who was born in Israel and who just completed her latest film, A Tale of Love and Darkness, an adaptation of the Israeli writer and journalist Amos Oz's memoir about the creation of Israel. An Israeli through and through, Portman recently was interviewed by the newspaper The Independent, where she made some rather crucial and courageous statements concerning the Zionist use of the Holocaust. Because of her credentials as a staunch and loyal Israeli, and given her popularity as a film star, her criticism resonates with many, especially the young, and it is the young Israelis who are refusing to fall into step with Zionist narratives that is rife with falsehoods and inaccuracies. Journalist Juan Cole picked up on the interview and wrote the following article. Actress Natalie Portman has kicked off a controversy with remarks about how to remember the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews, in which the National Socialists murdered 6 million people. Her critics have run off on tangents and presented a lot of red herrings. Portman did not question the distinctiveness of the Holocaust, but rather outlined what she thinks should be taken away from it. She made the remarks in an interview with The Independent. I think a really big question the Jewish community needs to ask itself is how much at the forefront we put Holocaust education, which is, of course, an important question to remember and to respect, but not over other things. We need to be reminded that hatred exists at all times and reminds us to be empathetic to other people that have experienced hatred also, not used as a paranoid way of thinking that we are victims. She continues, sometimes it can be subverted to fear-mongering and like another Holocaust is going to happen. We need to, of course, be aware that hatred exists. Anti-Semitism exists against all sorts of people, not in the same way. I don't mean to make false equivalences. We need it to serve as something that makes us empathetic to people rather than paranoid. She can pinpoint the moment that she came to this realization. It was in 2007 on a trip to Rwanda to trek with gorillas. She continues, "We went to the museum there, and I was shocked that that genocide was going on while I was in school. We were learning only about the Holocaust, and it was never mentioned, and it was happening while I was in school." That is exactly the type of problem with the way it's taught. I think it needs to be taught, and I can't speak for everyone because this was my personal education. Her remarks did not imply that Rwanda was equivalent to the genocide of the Jews. She was saying that people who lived through a Holocaust should be extra sensitive to massacres of others, should highlight these further genocides, not because they are equivalent, but because having been victims of genocide should produce empathy. She also warned against any fascist use of the Nazi genocide for the purpose of right-wing nationalism, the nursing of grievances against others, the paranoid political discourse that sees every political challenge as 1938 and every oppositional movement as equivalent to Nazism. She was talking not about history, but about psychology, not about comparative statistics, but about emotional maturity, not about past wrongs, but about a present-day moral compass. We all know Likudniks who use the genocide as a get-out-of-jail-free card, who think they can do no wrong because of the Holocaust. They are not unique. All massacres and genocides are available for both extreme nationalist and empathetic purposes. The difference does not lie in how many were tortured and killed. The difference lies in what we take away from it. Look at Japan. The Japanese right wing, exemplified by Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, has difficulty recognizing that Japan did anything wrong in the 1930s and 1940s. But the majority of the Japanese public is pacifist, despite having been nuked by the Truman administration. Two-thirds of the Japanese public reject Abe's legislation to allow the Japanese army to be deployed for warfare abroad. Whatever their resentments about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, most Japanese cite them as a reason for which war in general must be avoided. That is in the sort of spiritually mature manner that Portman is calling for. Note that I am not comparing the experience of civilians being nuclear bombed to the Nazi genocide against Jews. They are incommensurate experiences, both productive of a long-term historical trauma. The question is, how should we remember and deploy them in today's world? The majority of the Japanese public has the right idea, in my view. While I think there is something pathological about the Likud Party, just as there is about the Japanese right wing, it is legitimate for Jews to be wary of racial bigotry directed against them by populist movements and to take what steps they can to protect themselves from it. That is a lesson of genocide. But to confuse protests against the illegal Israeli annexation of the Palestinian West Bank with racism is just naked nationalism, a demand to be freed from all critique or constraint because of past suffering. It is not the demand of a grown-up. Portman is being prophetic in the tradition of the Hebrew Bible, where there were no voices more critical of ancient Jewry than the Isaiahs. She is calling us to turn hate and trauma not to the purposes of aggrandizement and suspicion, but to those of care for today's victims. Those who cannot understand her need to check their ethics. That was an article written by journalist Juan Cole. Next, good news on the BDS front. Veolia, one of the largest corporations in the world, was compelled by successful boycott and divestment campaigns that cost it more than $26 billion in contracts to sell off all its operations in Israel that violated international law. Congratulations to all BDS activists and cross-movement coalition partners around the world who made this happen. Special thanks to activists in Sweden, the UK, Ireland, the US, Kuwait, and of course the Netherlands, among other countries where Veolia lost lucrative contracts because of boycott pressure. The Palestinian BDS National Committee, the largest coalition in Palestinian society that leads the global BDS movement, will issue a statement soon emphasizing the need to continue pressure on Veolia until it pays reparations to the Palestinian communities adversely affected by its infringements of international law. The statement will also commit to standing in solidarity with other communities around the world whose rights are still trampled by Veolia. Veolia, a target of local BDS organizing, lost its contract to operate the Massachusetts commuter train system last year to the French company Keolis, which constitutes a huge victory for the local BDS movement. And in another BDS success story, one of the more prominent industrial unions in the United States voted to endorse the goals of the worldwide boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel, citing its long history of violating the human rights of the Palestinians, thus purportedly becoming the first nationwide union to do so. The United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers National Convention met in Baltimore and voted on a string of foreign as well as domestic policy issues, including the call to boycott Israel and support the nuclear deal with Iran. According to a statement on the UE's website, the union voted in favor of the justice and peace of the peoples of Palestine and Israel and cited Israel's sordid human rights record, starting with the ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Palestinians in 1947 and 48 that turned most of Palestine into the State of Israel. The move's goal, the union said, was to pressure Israel to end its apartheid over the Palestinians, just as similar tactics helped to end South African apartheid in the 1980s. The union further called for the U.S. aid to Israel to be cut off and expressed support for the right of return. The union also voted on a number of other foreign policy issues, including the demand to end U.S. military intervention in the Middle East and other regions. The vote on Israel was prompted by an encounter with Palestinian trade unionists during the World Social Forum in Tunisia. Delegate Orda Martinez, who co-sponsored the resolution and participated in the meeting, said, "It's absolutely disgusting what's going on." And that completes our news this morning. And now, moving on to our feature presentation. This morning, it is a speech delivered by Palestinian author and scholar Nadia Hijab at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. Here is her introduction, followed by her presentation.
The challenges posed by the vacuum in Palestinian political leadership is the topic of today's lecture. This is a timely topic indeed for everyone involved in Palestinian affairs, because as Nadia Hijab notes, the Palestinian national movement is experiencing serious fragmentation and paralysis. Some are uniting under the call and actions for BDS, and students and civil society organizations continue to mobilize. Nevertheless, between the multiple visions and policies of actors such as the PA, Hamas, aid and development organizations, destructive Israeli policies, and U.S. inaction, there are many factors that have had profound ramifications on the forms and viability of political leadership among the Palestinians. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Nadia Hijab. She's an old friend and a former executive director of the Jerusalem Fund. So welcome back. She's also a much respected colleague who analyzes so many different aspects of Arab affairs and especially policies about Palestine and the Palestinians. Currently, Nadia Hijab is the executive director of Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, which is a global think tank established in 2009 to put a stronger Palestinian policy voice on the map. She has co-founded or participated in several campaigns for Palestinian human rights in the United States, including the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. She was one of the co-founders. She's also a senior fellow at the Institute for Palestine Studies. Nadia Hijab's first book, which was titled Woman Power, The Arab Debate on Women at Work, was published by Cambridge University Press. She also co-authored Citizens Apart, A Portrait of the Palestinians in Israel, which was published by I.B. Torres. She's held senior positions at the United Nations, including the UN Development Program, among other assignments there. So please help me in welcoming Nadia Hijab.
Yeah, thank you very much, Zina, and it's a real pleasure to be here and to be back at the Palestine Center and the Jerusalem Fund. And to speak to you at what is a really pivotal time in our movement for Palestinian freedom. Am I coming through clearly? Can you all hear me okay? A bit more loudly? Okay. Okay. So, as everybody knows, the Israeli elections have dominated the news cycle in the U.S. For days. It's almost as though the whole world was focused on Palestine-Israel for the past few weeks. And in a way it was, because the Europeans, the U.S., the Palestine Liberation Organization, and the Palestine Authority were all desperately hoping that the Labor Party in Israel would win. Would come out ahead, at least, so that they could revive the peace process. Their disappointment must be huge. I mean, although the Labour Party did much better than expected, or much better than it had before, Netanyahu has come out ahead with 30 seats, 30 mandates in the Knesset. And you know, the largely Arab joint list also performed very well, but still, it's not yet in a position to shake the boat very much. And Netanyahu looks to be in line to form the next Israeli government. You know, ironically, a Netanyahu government makes the job of Palestinian civil society easier. Although, of course, it makes the job of the PLO and PA and the US and Europe much harder, and it's going to make the lives of the Palestinians on the ground much, much harder. Let's think about it. If Labour had been in position to form the next government, Palestinian civil society and the international solidarity movement would have faced a real challenge. We would have had to work very, very hard to prevent a deal that would inevitably undermine Palestinian rights. Because of the weakness and disarray of the Palestinian leadership, all that we could have expected or hoped from such a deal would be effectively more, maybe a bit more autonomy than what exists now, but no sovereignty of any kind. Actually, the Palestinian scholar Kamil Mansour wrote a paper for Shabaka several years ago where he showed that the maximum Israel position and the minimum Palestinian position, there was still a huge gap on sovereignty. So, I mean, that's worth going back to and reading. Things haven't changed. I mean, certainly, if they've changed, they've got much worse. So there would have been a bit more autonomy, a truncated state, and no right of return from any best-case outcome had there been a labor leadership. As it is, with Netanyahu's win of 30 seats compared to Labor's 24, Israel's racism and colonialism is now on full display, and the settler and army attacks on Palestinians under occupation in the West Bank and the army attacks on Gaza will rise. And maybe even these attacks will rise on Palestinian citizens of Israel. So now the Europeans, the U.S., and the PLO and the PA are going to have to take much more forceful action than they've been doing, or indeed than they've been wanting to, against the settlements. We have a gap between the Democrats and Republicans now over Israel, which is likely to grow, providing potential opportunity for civil society activism. And the PLO-PA will have to make much more forceful use of the international instruments that they have signed. Obviously, there's no time for complacency at all. It's not a good scene in any way. And the Palestinian movement, the Palestinian people and the international solidarity movement face many, many challenges. Israel is becoming increasingly ferocious as it moves inexorably to the right. As I said, its leaders no longer bother to hide the core Zionist objective, which is to eliminate the majority of the Palestinian people from the entire land of Palestine and to reserve it almost exclusively for the Jews. The coalition Netanyahu is likely to put together will be even more right-wing than the present one, difficult though that is to believe. In Gaza, Israel has been overseeing what is effectively a slow genocide of the besieged Palestinians in the Strip. This summer's attack was much more horrific than the previous three attacks, not only in terms of the scale of the destruction of entire neighborhoods and more than 2,000 Palestinian civilians killed, but also because it came after three other attacks after which there has been very, very little reconstruction of Gaza, with hundreds of families without shelter before this summer's attack. And still we see very, very little reconstruction underway. And people have had to try and survive one of the harshest winters in years. Since 2006, the Palestinians of Gaza have been losing access to safe water, sanitation, shelter, medical care, freedom of movement, and increasingly they're losing access to hope, which is the most important element in our survival and struggle for justice. If we move on to Gaza to look at the rest of Palestine, we see that it has been open season on the Palestinian citizens of Israel. I don't know if you took note, but about a few weeks ago, the 50th Palestinian citizen of Israel was killed since the year 2000. And as you know, the number of racist laws against Israel's Palestinian citizens is also on the rise, with growing talk of withdrawal of nationality and expulsion. In the West Bank and East Jerusalem, 50 Palestinians were killed in 2014 alone, and many, many more wounded. Jerusalem is living on a tinderbox. I mean, it could explode at any time, and there's very vicious and violent attacks and some counterattacks as well. And Israel is just pressing, fast-tracking its ethnic cleansing program against the Jerusalemite Palestinians through many bureaucratic procedures, like if a Palestinian cannot prove that Jerusalem is the center of their life, even though they are a Jerusalemite, their family has been a Jerusalemite for decades or centuries, they no longer can live in Jerusalem. And, of course, we witness the heartbreaking situation of Palestinian refugees, especially the refugees from Syria, but also other Palestinian refugees. And I want to say that beyond the direct suffering that's been imposed by Israel, the Palestinian people are gradually growing increasingly apart, with different narratives taking root in amongst different parts, segments of the different of the Palestinian people, because of the geographic separation. And you know, this is awful to say, but there's little knowledge and little love lost now between Gaza and the West Bank. This is one of the biggest challenges I think the Palestinian national movement faces. So today, the Palestinians in each part of Palestine are effectively left to fend for themselves as best they can, and in exile, with little or no help from the PLO and PA. Even worse, as you know, the PA has been for years the effective subcontractor for Israel in maintaining security in the West Bank. Among other things, they prevent demonstrations from getting too close to the Israelis. They get lists of suspects from the Israelis of people to arrest. And security and intelligence officials are now getting top jobs in government and the governorates. This has been very well described by my colleagues at the Shabaka, Ala Tartir and Sabreen Amro, and I really recommend you read their piece. They also wrote an op-ed for the New York Times, which was published a few months ago, on the security sector. We see little sign of a strategy to rebuild the PLO or to end the split between Fatah and Hamas so as to put the work for Palestinian rights back on course. Now, of course, we need to be fair. The PLO has taken several steps that are achievements for Palestinian rights, such as having Palestine recognized as a non-member observer state at the United Nations, and more recently, Palestine's application to join the International Criminal Court, which should go in effect in a couple of weeks on April 1st, and which has already led the court prosecutor to open a preliminary examination into the Gaza conflict. The problem here is that this doesn't appear to be part of a Palestinian strategy, a leadership strategy, to really use international instruments to best effect. For example, Palestinians had a fantastic win with the International Court of Justice advisory opinion on the wall in 2004, which was made very little use of by the PLO, despite the fact that it was a major victory. And after Palestine became a non-member observer state of the UN, it joined UNESCO, but did not fully make use of everything that UNESCO had to offer, which actually could have helped the PLO and the PA establish sovereignty. And, you know, we're talking sovereignty on land as well as on water. And this is why several Palestinian analysts, myself included, have viewed the ICC move with some skepticism as yet another effort by the PLO, PA, to get concessions from Israel at the negotiating table, or actually to get Israel back to the negotiating table with the U.S. The real tragedy, I feel, is that the Palestinian leadership has been focused on negotiations with Israel without having sufficient power and organization to achieve Palestinian rights. And this has been going on for decades, even before the Oslo Accords. But the Oslo Accords had a much more detrimental effect and made Palestinians dependent on Israel for almost everything, including the tax revenues, which Israel has now withheld. And still the leadership is sticking with it. Even when the leadership takes what seems to be a very brave and definitive decision, such as the PLO Central Council decision at the beginning of this month, to end security cooperation with Israel, it's hard to get excited. Because, first of all, it's simply a recommendation to Mahmoud Abbas. And secondly, you know, it's such a symbol of how far the Palestinian cause has plummeted when you're talking about ending security cooperation, you know, with your occupier. You know, how did we get there? I mean, it's just, it really is a tragic situation. Now, I think it will be very interesting to see if the Israeli elections have the same impact on the PLO-PA that they had on the Palestinian citizens of Israel. You know, the joint list was formed because the racist right-wing Israeli politician Avigdor Lieberman pushed to get the electoral threshold changed from 2 to 5% to make it into the, for parties to make it into the Knesset, which would have wiped out all the Arab parties, which was his goal. So the Palestinian parties, the political parties, came together, pushed by that, and had a very, very good result. The threats of losing any voice in the Knesset or any space in the Knesset and being completely at the mercy of the Israeli right helped get their act together. And, you know, as I said, they've strengthened their hand as a result and brought much more exposure to the rights of Palestinian citizens of Israel through the election campaign. In fact, I think one of the videos by Ayman Oudi, the head of the joint list, went viral when he was contrasting the joint list with, it's a very good video if you can get a hold of it, watch it, when he was contrasting the joint list with all the other Israeli parties. So just as the joint list had to get its act together, or the Palestinian citizens of Israel had to get their act together, maybe the PLO and PA, now that they have to face Netanyahu again, without hope of rescue from a labor-led government, maybe they'll finally be pushed to patch up the break between Fatah and Hamas. They may also be really pushed to finally end security cooperation with Israel at long last, and to really use these international instruments that they've successfully achieved for the Palestinians. Now, regardless of how things develop with the Palestinian leadership, Palestinian civil society and the international solidarity movement will have to continue to organize. We'll have to assume that there is a leadership vacuum, and we'll have to continue to organize around goals and strategies to address the challenges facing the Palestinian people. The good news here is that there are many ways in which Palestinian society is effectively organizing to deal with these challenges, and these areas, I find, are full of hope for the future. On the ground, Israel is strong, very strong. And the Palestinians are unprotected. But, and here's the irony, the stronger Israel is on the ground, the weaker it is internationally. And disastrously for Israel, the very idea of Israel, the notion, the concept that you can have a Jewish state that privileges some of its people at expense of other people, which is racist, really, and which has been at the core of the Zionist enterprise and Israel's foundation, and which has been hidden from Western eyes for decades, is now on full view. This concept is simply not acceptable in the 21st century. We sometimes forget that 1948 was not just the year when Palestine was lost. It was also the year when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted and began to be translated into international law. Now, of course, the law is one thing, and its implementation is another. People have to keep working to get the law applied. It doesn't apply itself. But the law is there, and it's there for us to use. And in fact, one of the challenges for Palestinian civil society is to prevent Israel from doing away with the whole framework of international law altogether so that it can get away with what it does. For example, it tried to get Western countries to defund the ICC, the International Criminal Court, so that it wouldn't be able to work on Palestine, the question of Palestine. And I was at a workshop last year that was organized, at which there were several European diplomats, and one European diplomat from, I believe, the Scandinavian countries said to me, or said to the workshop, you know, the reason we support the Palestinians is because it's in our interest to have the law upheld. We want a system based on the rule of law. That's why the rule of law is actually so crucial and so important. So now, because Israel's open racism and discrimination is shining a sharp spotlight on the racist colonial nature of the Zionist enterprise as a whole, throughout Europe and the United States, unprecedentedly large numbers of civil society activists and even politicians are opposing Israel's behavior and calling into question the Jewish state. This is giving strength to the Palestinian struggle in unexpected ways, and it's bringing new allies into the movement, even in the U.S., as a result of the active education campaigns by Palestinians and their allies. Over years and years, there's been a change in the discourse. And each time Israel has attacked Gaza, the number of supporters of rights for Palestinians has doubled or trebled, grown exponentially. across university campuses. Students for Justice in Palestine are a real rainbow coalition that includes Palestinian, American, Black American, Asians, Latino Americans, you know, and actually I understand that nearly half of the membership is American Jew, American Jewish. Their number has increased to about 60 universities across the U.S. The importance of these figures is that students from all these diverse backgrounds are America's future political and economic leaders. That's very important. And, by the way, they all support the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, BDS, movement. Perhaps the most unexpected, maybe not that unexpected, but certainly the most welcome new allies are the large and rapidly growing number of Jews who now support Palestinian rights in the U.S. and around the world. They're sickened by the Israeli policies that are so clearly racist and colonialist, and they're outraged that Israel claims to be speaking and acting in the name of Jews. I was just at the Jewish Voice for Peace national meeting this weekend in Baltimore, and it was an incredible outpouring of energy and activism from across the U.S., of not only Jews, the majority were Jews, but I was so surprised to see quite a few Palestinians there, Presbyterians and other Christian denominations. It was like people had poured in, and the energy and the strategic thinking was very, very impressive. JVP and groups like that play a very important role in the movement for human rights in Palestine and Israel. And here's just one reason why. Israel is now exploiting the terrorist attacks in Paris to really drive home the idea that criticism of Israel and its policies equals anti-Semitism. Of course, it has been doing this for years to stop pro-Palestinian groups organizing and to stop BDS actions and to prevent the Palestinian voice from being heard in the public sphere. And it's had some success. Because of its actions, for example, a recent British government report describes the Palestinian call for BDS, for boycott of Israeli academic institutions, as anti-Jewish and anti-Semitic, which is nothing of the sort. In fact, recently, the student associations at UCLA and UC Berkeley adopted resolutions conflating criticism of Israeli policies and anti-Semitism. So after the Paris attacks, Israel is redoubling its efforts to prevent criticism of Israel, to shut down the discourse and the debate. And this is very dangerous to our cause, and it's something we have to organize against. Criticizing Israel's policies does not mean attacking Jews. And one way to easily undermine this argument is to point to the now tens of thousands of Jews, including in JVP, who are working for Palestinian rights and for justice and human rights for all. Not half rights or quarter rights. JVP actually issued a statement recently putting its full weight behind BDS. And that means behind the right of return, in fact. So that is something quite powerful JVP is doing. I have a sense, I've been touring the States for the last month, and I have a sense that the movement for Palestinian rights has come of age in the U.S. The collaboration between different organizations now, I don't think we've witnessed it at this level before. There's been collaboration, of course, over the years. But now organizations such as the U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation, which I'm very proud to have co-founded, and the policy director, Josh Rubner, is here. It now has 400 groups in its coalition. You know, the collaboration between them and Jewish Voice for Peace and Code Pink and American Muslims for Palestine, among others, is really gelling now. And it was seen in the Skip the Speech movement that really took off. And you saw the number as hundreds of thousands of activists and grassroots organizations and many others wrote into their congressional people. You saw the number of people who decided to skip the speech rise from 20 to 30 to 40 to 50 and finally to 60 of congressional representatives who decided to skip the speech. Of course, there were other factors as well, but I think the grassroots activism was one of the main factors. Just a few more things to say before closing. BDS, I can see Zaina getting it just a slightly... No, you're not. BDS, so just to turn to BDS for a couple of minutes. It's one of the major sources, I think, of the strength for the movement for Palestinian human rights. And for me, it's a source of pride that Palestinian civil society is capable of that kind of strategic thinking and creativity that led to the BDS call. I'm sure you all know the kind of actions and impact that BDS has had across the world, driving people to filmmakers, artists, musicians to cancel partnerships and major companies to cancel contracts or to pull out, and contributing to the fact that some European governments are finally drawing a line between settlement products and Israel. And here's the thing, it's important to remember that BDS is a strategy. It's a tactic. It's a very, very good strategy, a very powerful one, but it is not the goal. There are goals for the Palestinian movement, and what is very important about the BDS call, it is set out those goals. Because for many Palestinians and many in the solidarity movement, we had forgotten what our goals were. Okay, a state. But, you know, if we get a state on half of Palestine, does that mean we've succeeded? Should we stop? If we get a, you know, what level of... Yeah, what are our goals as a Palestinian national movement? These are very clearly set out in the BDS call. How do we express our self-determination? One, through freedom from occupation. Two, for equality of the citizens of Israel. Three, for justice for the Palestinian refugees. Freedom, justice, equality. Those are the goals of the movement, and it's very important to educate around those goals, because otherwise, if there's another bad deal on the horizon, like Oslo was, you know, people may say, oh, good, you know, they're solving it, I'm going to go home and, you know, plant my garden or whatever, the issue is finished. That happened after Oslo, the international solidarity movement demobilized. But if we are very aware that these are the three goals that we're working for and that we do not stop work until they're achieved, then we carry on. Another area where more work has been needed, and I'm glad to say that some of us are doing this, is enabling Palestinian policy voices to engage in the policy debates in think tanks and academic institutions, especially in the U.S. and Europe. In the U.S., which is really the biggest battleground for Palestinian rights, Palestinian policy voices are largely missing, or worse, the policy message is distorted, including by Palestinians eager to curry favor with the administration. And that's why a small group of us came together a few years ago, in 2009, to establish a Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, which was actually launched in April 2010. As Zaina said, you know, this is a think tank. Al-Shabaka is a think tank without walls or borders. Through it, we seek to turn one of our greatest weaknesses, which is our dispersal all over the world, into a strength to use electronic tools to bring those voices to strategize and work on policy together. It's about putting a stronger policy voice on the map by tapping Palestinian expertise and experience. We're very happy that the Shabaka includes established scholars as well as new emerging voices. Many, many of the authors of recent pieces of a Shabaka have been young analysts, young scholars. We publish everything in English because we want American and European policymakers to understand that we will not accept anything less than our full rights. And we publish everything in Arabic, of course, because it's very important for our own people, for policymakers, the Arab world, to engage, and the Palestinians themselves, to engage in strategy development and to promote policies that address the challenges that face us. I want to encourage you all to join the email list at Al-Shabaka if you're not on it already. I believe there's flyers at the door and that have been distributed to you as you came in, so please do. So I've just tried to set out some ideas for discussion. This is a very well-informed group, and I'm very much looking forward to our discussion. Thank you very much.
That was Nadia Hijab speaking at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. That is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at www.wzbc.org or listen to us at any time via the archive found on the WZBC homepage. Simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. Each program is on this archive for 2 weeks. To reach our permanent full archive of past broadcasts, browse to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. That is our full archive of past broadcasts maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
Hello and welcome to Dialect. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, Amy Powell joins us. The Monday Art Club starting up in Easton. Also, 9/11, the anniversary is coming up, and we look tonight at George Bush's role as a puppet on the day. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join us, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen's Square on 0117 989 7733 or online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. But first this week, joining me on the line is Sabine McNeil. Hi, Sabine. First of all, your website, victimsunite.net, just tell us about your role in this, because you seem to coordinate between quite a lot of people who are having trouble in different ways. What are the main themes on your site?
Well, the themes are emerging as I meet people, Tony. It developed from the meetings that I organized at the House of Lords, which at the time were focusing on Forum for Stable Currencies, i.e. the monetary analysis, but that's where victims showed up and I wanted to help them and I didn't know how.
So how did you go from analysing the money system to victims?
Well, they came to me and I realised that they would just be happy to get some kind of acknowledgement by having a summary of their story published. That's how I started. In fact, I started the first cases on the website called Enforcement of Bank of England Act 1694. And Lord Sudley had said, with whom I had started the Forum for Stable Currencies, he had said that we must group cases to change the law. So that's how I actually began and why I began to group cases. And I started with the four worst fraudulent bankruptcies.
What about, stable currencies? At the moment, we don't seem to really have that, do we? We're in a situation where it seems that any minute the world could go crazy if the Chinese stock market crashes. And we're also in a situation in Europe with the Eurozone that there's not a lot stable about Greece. Even though the euro itself seems to be stable, there's something wrong. Greece is really suffering, and other countries too.
or what is wrong with the monetary system all over the world is terribly fundamental, and it's very sad how few people understand and know that. At the time when we tried to find the right name for the Forum for Stable Currencies, Donald Martin, whom I had invited to chair, said if we call it stable, we should get the Bank of England behind us, but of course we never did, because we found out that they are just dealing with money and currencies like everybody else who make money out of money, which is, of course, the deadly sin in Islam, which links back to your terrorism story, because in my view, that's exactly why Muslims have become terrorists, because they know what should happen with money. So for a currency to be stable, it should, first of all, not be traded. I mean, by trading currencies, you change the price, you change the market value.
Well, it does seem that we have quite a lot of gambling. It's almost like the casino and the bank marketplace has become one.
Absolutely. I mean, yes. It's completely casino capitalism. And when I was in Germany, everybody was just talking about fake money, instead of fiat money, because that's what it boils down to. It's completely ridiculous what's happening. But what's more ridiculous, how many people buy into it. And of course, what's most ridiculous is that we don't have a choice. We have to just go along with it. So one of my dreams is to create the ethical investment network to make money out of money, which is, of course, completely against my principles. But at least before I die, I need to do something good with it, you know. So that's the project, one of the projects I'm after and trying to reiterate or revitalize.
You're talking about the Islamic approach to finance there. I mean, I know, for example, you know, that they take a very serious view of things like as simple as interest. In fact, if you go back a couple of hundred years in Britain, apparently the Christian law was the same, wasn't it? You know, they had church courts and things like that, and there wasn't usury, it was called, was illegal in Britain, and in fact across most of Europe in the Protestant world.
Absolutely. Lord Sudley, with whom I founded the Forum for Stable Currencies at the House of Lords at the time, had written very beautifully about it, that it's been forbidden in all philosophies, but in Islam, in a way, most explicit. Making money out of money is a deadly sin called riba. And yes, taking interest, i.e. lending and borrowing at interest, is not on, and that is based on the mathematics of compounding interest, which is exponential, which is the real reason why everybody talks about growth. I mean, that is an infinite growth. I mean, Margaret Kennedy had written about that. And of course, stable currencies are experienced in local exchange trading systems and barter companies.
Well, we've got the Bristol Pound here in the city here.
Yes, and that's why my model has always been what happens in LED systems and barter companies, but I don't know whether I was ahead of my time or whether it's just, I guess it's just too big a system to be up against, and one can only make a difference if one is maybe part of the system rather than outside.
Well, I heard you may have heard this story too, Sabine, I'm not sure. This is, I think, back in the 1990s, some people working on coming up with alternatives to the financial system as we have it now had decided to spend, I think it was a long, almost like a retreat, discussing it and to draft a kind of better system for enabling people to bring in let's schemes around the country, that is these alternative currencies like the Bristol Pound kind of thing, but almost like a Bible of how to do it and how to make it work, including things like, you know, get your local authority on board by enabling people to pay a small amount of their council tax or rates or whatever, you know, using this currency, and that would be effective. And they were travelling back home from wherever it was, and they stopped. I think the woman I spoke to said it was on Silbury Hill, and they left the car at the bottom of the hill, went up and had a sort of, you know, sort of lie in the sun and, you know, almost contemplating what they were doing. When they came back to the car, they found the car had been broken into and all their notes stolen. And as a result of that, what she told me, I wish I could remember her name, I can't. What she told me was that she went back home and wrote the paper, which effectively ended up as a pamphlet, just from memory, because the actual all the words had been stolen from the car. And actually, it was a fantastic, paper. It was very successful, and it helped a lot of Let's schemes in the 1990s get off the ground. The irony being that she was then phoned, I think, just after the publication of the pamphlet by Wiltshire Police to say, "Oh, we found all your papers." But anyway, look, what I'm really asking here about is I'm just asking for you to explain to us a bit more about the connection between people coming to you. I mean, you've got a bit of a think tank going there about looking at the money system, what's wrong with it, how to fix it, and then you get victims of the money system coming.
Well, that's exactly the point. If we had a proper money system, we wouldn't have the victims that we have. The money system is the cause, the victims are the effects, because there is never enough money around. And of course, the seduction of buying more and consuming more.
But hang on, I've got to stop you there, because for some people there is. I mean, there seem to be people out there who've got lots of money to invest, even just buying empty buildings, almost like it's money in the bank, just as an investment. You know, so some people, and also, of course, a lot of big corporations that haven't been paying their tax, they are swimming in money. So there are some people around, even if it's only the 1%, with quite a lot of money.
Yes, but of course that is the, if you like, the mechanism of compounding interest on interest as well. And of course the main interest that is being imposed is always on the government, i.e. the national debt. And that effect of demanding money on the government budget and having that built in, of course, means that all of the public services go down. And there's never enough money for health and education, but always for other bad things. And yes, Let's Link is still going. Professional barter companies are still going. And there is also a group of technologists who are very interested in making a difference in the financial system. But if, whether and when it will make enough of a difference so that really the whole gap is closed between the 1 and the 99%, or appears at least to be closing. God only knows what has to happen, Tony.
Also, you know, your Victims Unite these days tends to focus on this child snatching by the state business. And I know, doesn't he write for the Daily Telegraph? Christopher Booker has been really good on this subject, getting some of these cases out to the general public.
Oh, yeah. Christopher Booker is the one and only journalist, and John Hemming was the one and only parliamentarian who've been very, very good. He writes for The Telegraph. He has a Sunday column, a weekly column in The Telegraph, and climate change is one of his topics, and then the child snatching business. Yes, I just spoke to him recently about the case that came my way, which is so horrendous again. And he said, oh, yes, London Borough of Sutton is definitely amongst the worst. I mean, I hadn't come across that yet, but I ended up accompanying this wonderful Zimbabwean lady who had studied in Berlin civil engineering. So she was fluent in German. And her son had been taken into care by the police. It was just so ridiculous on May 8th, and now we all have problems trying to get him back.
Tell us the circumstances. How was her child taken? Where?
He happened to have been in transit between Switzerland and Zimbabwe because they were relocating. They were going back to Zimbabwe after so and so many years in Switzerland. And visiting family in London, there was a bit of an issue and about the passport of the boy, and one of the relatives phoned the police, which was, of course, completely stupid. But the police, oh, there's a child. Oh, we can catch it. Oh, we can snatch it. So that was the beginning, and I just only read now the report of what they call a LAC, which is a looked after children, about a meeting held in June. I accompanied her yesterday to this.
But I mean, surely, Sabine, you can understand the police's attitude, because they've been accused in the past of not acting tough enough right around the world on some of these children actually being abused, and then the police not intervening. So they've been criticised for that.
You know, police is just like social services. John Hemming always says social services get involved when they shouldn't and they don't get involved when they should. So in this case, that's definitely also that applies to the police. And of course, social services can't take children without police. So police are heavily involved. And I mean, in this case, the boy has now been exposed to a hell of a lot of a bigger risk whilst in care, in quotes, than ever, ever, ever with his mother. And so this fundamental turning and inversion of innocence and guilt is what really gets to me. Would you believe it? First of all, I'm now reading that he tried to escape at least three times, obviously because he was unhappy. Then there was an incident where he had an excessive dose of drugs for some reason. And then he even got involved in a stabbing 30 miles away. God only knows how he got there.
And this is in care.
I saw him with his right hand still being bandaged. The mother had never been informed. The social worker bragged about having been with the boy till 10 o'clock at night. But would he call the mother? No, she didn't. She still has just had an absolute minimum of information. It is so terrible. And yesterday in the meeting, as a third incident, we learned that he had smoked cannabis in his room. And Tony, I can't remember the precise reason that they had given, but this boy had two staff, they call it 2-for-1 supervision 24 hours round, but not in his room. So they know that it was a past visitor who came who must have given him this cannabis. But the so-called independent review officer said, if your son wants to get hold of drugs, he will, no matter what. So, I mean, excuse me, why can't they let the boy go?
Good question. I know also recently there's been the case of Joni Cameron Blair. I'm not sure if you've come across that, Sabine, but she was up in Nottingham. She was in care herself as a youngster for a short time. And while she was, she witnessed rape going on in this particular care home in Nottingham. And when she left care, she was taken back by her parents into a much better situation. When she became a teenager in her early 20s, she then applied for a job and got it as a care home inspector, only to then find that the reports that she was doing were basically buried. And she'd go back maybe 1 or 2 years after she'd done a damning report about members of staff who were being abusive to the children in all sorts of different ways, using psychological bullying, this kind of thing, physical abuse, etc., to find those people still in their jobs.
I wouldn't be surprised, because I now had this privilege of seeing two of such homes. I mean, they all look wonderful, and I was wondering, you know, where does the money come from to equip them beautifully? There were two children in each of the homes and three staff. I mean, you can just about imagine that this is what I call the people processing industry. You know, children in, children out. But for what purpose? Who benefits? The staff that is there. Okay, obviously, once the council has employed some people, they must keep them going. But when I told the mother that he now suddenly wears his hair in a braided way, she was wondering whether you want to turn him into a gay boy. And when I spoke to him, he certainly was just sort of like any teenager nowadays, bored with life, not knowing what to do with himself. And then I learned, because they were exposed to the care plan and education, that he's supposed to go on to a sexual health workshop. And he was told, it says in the report, that having sex under 16 is a crime in the UK. I mean, who needs to expose him to that? Why?
Also, one of the recurring themes when we have a chat, Sabine, is just making sure that anyone listening that knows someone that's in one of these situations, either with a relative, friend, loved one, or whatever, that's knows somebody who's had a bad time in one of these official care homes, or else, you know, the other way around, maybe they are actually in an abusive situation in a family, of that kind of thing. Where would you say it's got to be the first point of call for people like that?
Well, unfortunately, our McKinsey site does attract people, but I can't cope with individual cases anymore. Tony, I walked out weeping yesterday. I was in tears when I got a phone call from somebody today again. But we are just a handful of volunteers.
And what about lawyers, police? You know, where can one turn? I mean, the police do say, don't they, that really since the Jimmy Savile expose, that they're actually starting to take this much more seriously.
Well, maybe in words, but in deeds, I haven't seen yet. I mean, I mustn't talk about it, but I do know this police station now from the inside as well, and I cannot trust anybody at all. And with this mother also, she had already been disappointed by two solicitors. That's why she found us. And
say, for example, internet forums, things like that, where at least people can discuss it? I don't know, even maybe Facebook, that kind of thing.
Yes, that's exactly where people are getting together and help each other. That's precisely the one and only hope that we have.
Okay. Also, I know you've got an article on victimsunite.net about house stealing too. Never mind taking away the children, but stealing your home. What's that all about?
Well, that's how it all started for me until I realized that child snatching was the worst of all white-collar crimes. I mean, these fraudulent house repossessions and lenders registry fakes and, I mean, frauds. Whether it's tax, whether it's land registry, I mean, force, you name it, I've seen it. And I always just feel helpless, basically. And at least there is some exposure. And, you know, sadly enough, very, very many people just get some solace out of that and get over it. At least they've been heard. At least it's exposed. At least they can keep referring to the website and their case. If, whether, when things will change, I mean... Once again, I just refer back to the money system. If we had a nicer, I mean, more sane, more balanced money system, people wouldn't go to these extremes of being as nasty as they are and abuse their public service positions. That's what it boils down to, in my view.
Okay, Sabine McNeil, editor, actually not quite editor, of victims-unite.net. Thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect.
You're most welcome. Thank you for having me, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined now by Rosa Hewitt and Amy Powell, who are looking at doing some art down in Eastern. Hi, Rosa, and hi, Amy.
Hello.
First of all, tell us a bit about yourself, Rosa. Are you actually an artist? Have you trained and... Or are you sort of self-made artist? Have you decided to get and do it yourself? Have you had any sort of formal training?
Well, I went to art school. I went and studied fine art at UWE in Bristol. And, yes, I am an artist of sorts.
Okay, so what tell us about, you know, what you get doing fine art at UWE. So how is it, 3-4 years?
It's a 3-year degree, BA. And, I completed that and finished it last year.
Take us through the sort of stuff you're doing as part of that 3 years. You know, what kind of...
Well, it's really dependent for each student. For me, I focused a lot on video work during my degree, but it's not necessarily my main interest in art. I'd say I'm a mixed media artist. I do a lot of drawing, I do a lot of painting, I write a lot as well, and that... all fed into my video work. At the moment, I'm mainly drawing and painting, so...
I mean, is the idea of a degree like that that you start to discover your creative, you know, what makes you tick?
Yeah, I guess so. And also, you know, understanding where you come at work conceptually and how that works, and also the use of facilities in a big university are incredible. So it's great to have that opportunity to be able to explore different mediums and different facilities.
And do you have to actually be able to draw, say, for example, be able to sketch, that kind of thing, with
no,
a pencil?
Not for a fine art degree, I don't think so. No, not necessarily. It's a lot to do with, you know, so many different things I could say about it, but in terms of drawing is not necessarily the main thing. You might be a drawer, you might be a painter, you might be abstract, you might be realist, but you know, everyone's completely different who were on our course anyway, so yeah.
What led you to do video? What was it attracted you about that?
Well, I did a lot of photography, and I wanted to make the photos move, so I decided to make
That's
videos.
The only way, I think,
yeah,
as far as I know,
that would work.
Unless you dangle a photo on a piece of string and let it
blow
in the wind.
Yeah, you could also do that.
Not quite the same though.
But then I'd want to make a video out of that too.
What did you discover about yourself as an artist during those 3 years? You know, what was it that you thought? You know, is it leading you in any particular directions?
Well, I think the main thing that I discovered about myself is that I can't fit myself into a box. I'm not necessarily going to be a big selling artist, and I also realise that that's not important, and also that I get joy out of making art, and that's the most important thing for me, is to just keep getting joy out of it, keep being creative. Because I was going to go and study psychology before I decided to do a fine art degree, and I realised I couldn't let go of art, and I still can't let go of it. So I guess that's the reason why I studied it.
At the end of the day, do you think it's going to contribute towards an income? Is it contributing towards making money? I mean, because there's a lot of emphasis, certainly by the latest Conservative government, in we're only going to be spending money. Actually, of course, you have to borrow money now to do these courses. But how vocational is it, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say?
Well, it really depends on what you decide to go and do. So a lot of people do internships afterwards, maybe work for artists, maybe becoming an artist yourself, I think, is very hard, to be a big-selling artist. I don't think it's going to be my sole income, but I also think, in a way, for myself, it means that it's not going to take the life and soul out of what I'm making. And, most important thing is that I keep enjoying it, and I don't really think it matters whether it's vocational or not, but,
Just do it, sounds to me like the approach.
Just,
if you've got something you want to do, just get on and do it. What about you, Amy? Are you someone that's studied art at university, that kind of thing, or come to it just from your own inclinations?
Well, I went to the same university as Rosa.
Same course?
Yeah, the same course.
Same year?
Yeah, same course, same year.
Right,
same tutor group at one point as well. So we went for it together. And part of our course, we also did an Erasmus exchange as well, where you go to another university. So we both did that as well.
Okay, where did you go?
We went to Rotterdam. We went to William de Kooning in Rotterdam. And as part of that, we were doing some volunteer work, where we worked in a centre for sort of people who sort of had experience living on the streets or had mental health problems. And we were doing art with art at that centre, and we really enjoyed it. And then when we graduated, it just seemed like a really good idea to try and do a project together. So that's what we've decided to do.
So that sounds amazing. I mean, with people who've been living on the streets, what kind of artworks came out of that?
The centre was engaging people who wouldn't really engage with other services. So they had a sort of a music recording centre. So there's a lot of street hip-hop artists who were recording, and then they had painting as well. They had a room where people did painting, and we just joined in with what was going on, really. We didn't teach anyone anything, we just joined in, and it really worked very well, and it was and I think it was good for the people who were at that centre to have other people coming in and sort of seeing the work we were doing, and it was great for us to see the work they were doing as well.
How long were you in Holland for then?
We were there for 6 months.
And how did you find it, compared to Bristol?
I don't know. I think it's a very different city, because it's a lot more built up, and it's a lot more sort of feels quite a lot more in it's a much bigger city. And, I think, I went there trying to sort of see if I could build a new life in another country.
Yeah.
And that was kind of part of what I was trying to do there. And I got involved with couch surfing and got to know people. And, and I got to know an established squat, basically. It had been a squat for a long time, and it was a really old building. And there was about 30 people living there. And what they did was they ran a sort of Sunday dinner where people could come along and eat and meet each other and things. And it was a really interesting centre. And I got to know people through that.
What about the language? I mean, for most of us, descending on even if it's a European country that speaks a completely different language is a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, well, I didn't learn the Dutch.
The Dutch love speaking English.
They speak a lot of English. And I used to do a thing where I went to the market. I go to the market every week and buy food. And I'd always take a whole load of 2 euro coins because I knew nothing would cost more than 2 euros. So for everything I bought, I'd give them 2 euros.
Did you do that? That's so funny.
So it was a way of getting around the fact I couldn't speak the language.
And what have you managed to turn that into, you know, what you learnt at university, the course, into making money? I hate to come back to this, but this whole vocational thing, do you think that it's something that you can somehow turn into something that can help you get an income in the future?
Well, I think the thing that really I was interested in at university was how, like, art can be a tool for personal and social change. That's something I'm really interested in, and how art can be something that can be of benefit to the community. And I'm very interested in, like, sort of what's going on politically around what this government's doing and where we're heading. And I see that art can be a powerful tool within that, as a form of protest or a form of bringing people together or a way of people processing what's gone on for them. And that was something I was really interested in.
Can you give us an example of how that... I mean, I know I'm thinking actually about things like 1968 in Paris, where there was a lot of artistry involved in these massive street protests right across the city of Paris in the 1960s. But what have you experienced that actually somehow expresses things, which is, I suppose, what we're talking about here, is anger with a society that doesn't seem to care about people?
Yeah, I think art can articulate something. Like, someone can do a picture that really articulates something, and I think Banksy's really great at that. That his pictures are like almost one-line jokes, you know, and that people can look at that and think, can really relate to that. And that's something I'm really interested in. And I made a piece of artwork at uni that was my final degree show piece, which was a flat pack force feeding chair. So the idea was that you'd sort of put it together and then it was just like this idea of how society's forced on us. And I've had that exhibited twice. It got exhibited at the Passion for Freedom exhibition in London, and it also got exhibited at the Bath Art Fringe. And that was really good fun. And we did a performance where we strapped people in it and fed them Angel Delight.
Well, I suppose that is delightful, but that's great because it's two things, isn't it? It's actually quite nice to Angel Delight, but to be force-fed it is something pretty horrific. I think it sounds like fantastic stuff you're doing. But you're interested, you're just about to start a club on Mondays, aren't you, in Easton? Can you tell us about that, maybe... you, Rosa?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So we're wanting to start a small project on Mondays in September in Easton, the first of which you will hear about on this show is the 14th of September. Then we'll do the 21st of September and the 28th. The idea of the project is to do small art workshops. They're pretty DIY. They're nothing too wild or, you know... the idea is to just get people to start making and start being creative. So the first one we're doing on the 14th will be experimental drawing. The second on the 21st will be painting to music. And the last one is going to be collage making and possibly another activity thrown in with that. And the idea is that people come to it, but that we would like them to email us before coming so we have an idea of numbers in terms of materials. And we want to just see what people think about doing the workshops, how they feel about it, maybe have some feedback at the end, have a chat about it, see what worked and stuff. Because, of course, we're relatively new to doing this. We want to create something that's helpful and exciting for people to come to. And also, you know, really make it about the community that are coming to the workshops. You know, we don't want to say this is the way it is and then do something that's not interesting and fun for people, because that's really important.
Now, Amy, I know the Cabelli is just up Robertson Road from the junction of Robertson Road and Stapleton Road in Easton. But tell us a bit about the centre, the place.
Well, it's a political centre. It's an alternative political centre. And it's run on a collective basis, and they're very keen on making things as accessible as possible for people, and they have like bike workshops, and they have events where they raise money, and they have a sort of a meal on a Sunday. And the reason why I thought it'd be a really great place to work with was because they have was a venue for, that we could use, and also they have an art room, so they had some of the materials already. And I think what I really hope with this project is that we bring more people into the Cabelli Centre, and sort of also I like the way that they were quite supportive of us doing something different.
Yes, it sounds like an interesting place. Lots going on there. Probably worth... Is it sort of open at any part of the week where people can just sort of pop in and have a look and see what's going on there at all?
I'm not so sure. I know they have a bike workshop and they have a Sunday meal. But yeah, I think if you want to find more details, look on the Cabelli website.
Okay. If you're interested in the Cabelli Centre, but not necessarily in the art, every Sunday, 6:30 to 8:45, delicious vegan dinner for a suggested donation of £2.50, which is rather nice to suggest a donation rather than a charge. So if you're absolutely, you know, maybe you've been sanctioned on benefits or something, then it's only a donation that they're asking for from 6:30 till 8:45 at the just up from the junction of Robertson Road and Stapleton Road. That's the Cabelli Community Co-op. And the website is network23.org/Cabelli, which is spelled K-E-B-E-L-E. Now, Rosa, how much is your Monday course going to cost? Yours is it's 7 till 9 every Monday, isn't it, up until the end of September?
Yes, it is 7 till 9 p.m. and it is actually free. Completely free.
What about email address? You said you wanted people to email
sure,
you.
Absolutely.
And your phone number, please, too.
Yes. So if you would like to get in contact about the workshops and you'd like to come, that would be fantastic, or you just want to ask some questions, you can either call me on 07887 490 484, or you can send me an email on rosahewitt@hotmail.com. You can also look us up on our Facebook page, which is Art at the Cabelli Centre. That's K-E-B-E-L-E, as mentioned before. So, yeah, those three ways, email, phone or the Facebook page.
Just one thing, Rosa Hewitt. How do you spell Hewitt?
H-E-W-I-T-T.
Fantastic. And what I'll do is I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show in case you didn't catch them then. So, Rosa Hewitt and Amy Powell, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Well, he's the author of 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in USA. And as another anniversary of the September the 11th attacks that have introduced the world to this wonderful concept called the War on Terror, which has really taken any chance away, it seems, of the peace dividend at the end of the Cold War, Webster Tarpley is your man. He's certainly one of the best authors on the subject, and he was in Bristol back in 2008 speaking at QEH Hall about it. But when he was in Bristol all that time ago, I spoke to him about one particular aspect of September the 11th, because he rather took issue with the idea that people in America were having bumper stickers that said Bush knew. So although there were certainly aspects of an inside job to the September the 11th attacks, Webster Tarpley told me, as you're about to hear, that he thought that people misunderstood often George Bush's role, who was Republican president at the time.
Not enough attention has been paid to the political evidence, and the political evidence is two things. One is the ultimatum to Bush from the secret government, from the rogue network. In other words, the people who carry out 9/11 send Bush a threat. Angel is next, Angel being the code word for Air Force One. And it means, Bush, you are a target, with the idea then being, if you don't do what we want, we can do without you. We can liquidate you even in the course of the day. And what they want is the war of civilizations. They want him to announce terrorism. They want him to start talking about bin Laden, Al-Qaeda. They want him to invade Afghanistan. And when this threat comes in at 9 to 10 o'clock in the morning, I have a whole chapter in my book about it. I'm indeed the only person who writes about it. The thing is in the New York Times, confirmed by Condoleezza Rice. There's no doubt that it happened, and it's real. Debka, that is not Debka, but the, Debka, which is, of course, close to the Mossad in many ways, they confirmed it. Namakan, a group of KGB old boys who have an internet site in Russian, they confirmed it. And Réseau Voltaire, using, I believe, Russian and maybe some French sources, also confirmed that this happened. So Thierry Maison, the first guy who really wrote about 9/11, is also on this line. So the idea, therefore, is that Bush is not a part of this planning. He's not a mastermind. He's not somebody who's, you know, told in advance what's going to happen. He's put in front of a fait accompli. One of the points of this thing is to get him to be active in a way that he would not do otherwise, since his general personality state is catatonic.
And slowly over the day, his line changes.
Right. Yeah, because he says terrorism in the school in Florida. He says terrorism, and then when he gets to Barksdale, Louisiana, he says he does not mention terrorism again. And then when he finally makes a speech in Washington in the evening, he makes clear that he has capitulated to the rogue network in the course of the day by saying, we will make no distinction between terrorists and those who harbor them. And by that time, with Richard Clark screaming, bin Laden, Al Qaeda the entire day, it's clear that that means he's going to invade Afghanistan. So he has, in effect, capitulated to the rogue network, or, you know, rushed to become their eager puppet. And that's something that, you know, Tony Blair reportedly prodded him to do it. Tony Blair came in on the side of starting the war of civilization. So that's the angel is next. It was denied later by the White House, but it did happen. And then what? Then we have the drills, right? That's the other thing. 25-plus drills. A lot of them are taking place on the morning of September 11th. Some of them have just been wrapped up in May, June, July, August. Some of them are in advanced stages of planning. So these represent capabilities. 25-plus drills, you don't have to take my word for it. Paul Thompson, even though Paul Thompson really believes in the official version, has done yeoman service. If you look at the 9/11 complete timeline of Paul Thompson at Cooperative Research on the Internet, he's got a whole long article, which is nothing but the drills of 9/11.
And now, probably the most important of those is the nuclear war fighting drill.
That would be the Global Guardian drill, right? That the skies are filled with nuclear bombers, the missiles and submarine-launched missiles are ready to go. Ivashov in Moscow says before any airliner was hijacked, he could see a huge display of thermonuclear power being put into the skies, right, from the satellites and radar that he had. And that is obviously designed to intimidate Russia and to prepare for the fact that in the course of the day, one of the things the rogue network wants is to give an ultimatum to Russia that the U.S. is going to seize Afghanistan, which is a country that in the past Russia had considered essential to her security, and they'd fought, God knows, a bloody war for 10 years to keep the place neutral. And it had remained neutral, more or less. But now the U.S. is going to seize it. A certain kind of Red Army traditionalist might have said, no, that's casus belli. Of course, Putin, much more flexible, highly intelligent. I thank the lucky stars for Putin on that day and since. He is the most intelligent and flexible head of state in the world that we have. And he chose a policy of war avoidance, which was to say to the neocons, you want Afghanistan? Wonderful, take it. You'll see what you find.
Okay.
Weakness and defeat, and Russia will get stronger, and the U.S. will get weaker, and that's exactly what has happened.
That was Webster Tarpley, Webster Griffin Tarpley, to be precise. One of the, I think, best speakers about the September 11th attacks, someone who really puts together how these kinds of operations can be done by remote control, effectively, and somebody who wasn't anything to do with it being blamed, effectively, a conspiracy theory, isn't it, that Osama bin Laden carried out the 9/11 attacks from his little cave down in Afghanistan. And Webster Tarpley's book, if you want to read it, is called 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Back in the late 1990s, the Prophecy Club in the United States took a series of unique insights into prophecy. not Old Testament style, but modern prophecy, with the focus on how the Bible could be speaking directly to us today. Gail Riplinger is a US writer who uncovered some shocking ways in which Rupert Murdoch's version of the Bible, yes, he does have one, the translation which he owns is called the New International Version, misses out entire phrases from the original Greek, deleting references to fasting and prayer, for example, and even whole sets of verses are gone, as they are from the New King James Version, which Gail believes has been altered. So here's Gail Riplinger talking about what she found researching her book, New Age Bible Versions.
In Madame Blavatsky's book, the title, The One, capital O-N-E, is so prevalent that she has a chapter called The One. And in that book, her occult book called The Secret Doctrine, she says that the dragon is the one, Lucifer is the one, Sanat, which is really just a scramble for Satan, is the one. The serpent is the one. It goes on and on and on. Now, we also see another change in the NIV. Okay, the King James talks about the Lord Jesus Christ, and it says, the household of God, that's all of us who are saved, is built upon the foundation of Jesus Christ, the chief cornerstone. Now, when I was a professor at Kent State University for several years, I taught architecture. And a cornerstone, as defined in an architectural dictionary, is at the foundation of a building. It sets the angles for the building, okay? Now, the NIV has replaced that with the capstone, okay? A capstone is on the top of a building, all right? Now, this was taken off the backside of a dollar. This is the great seal that was put on there by FDR. We all know about his Masonic influence, but Zechariah 11:17 talks about the Antichrist, and it says his right eye shall be utterly darkened. So whoever the Antichrist is only has one eye left to peer out, and there it is. All right. So we've got the capstone instead of the cornerstone in the new versions. Okay. Now, Jesus said, go into all the world and preach the gospel. Just don't use more than 200 words. Okay? Now, he didn't really say that. But can you imagine going into a foreign country or going to Canada or going someplace? You've used 200 words, and you've got to get copyright permission from someone to use any more. Because all of the new versions are copywritten. And the copyright law says that anytime you use more than 200 words, and it will say this in the front of many of these editions. In fact, I know of a number of lawsuits. The New American Standard was guilty of suing some missionaries in the Far East. They're not actually suing them, but harassing them, I should say. Until they would quit using more than 200 words. And so if we can only use 200 words without getting permission for these new versions, who are we going to go to? Okay, who has the power to give us permission to use more than 200 words? Okay, we've got a picture of Brother Bill here, Mr. Greenspan of the Federal Reserve, and Rupert Murdoch. Okay, this came from a national news magazine. It was either Time or Newsweek. They considered these three men the most powerful men in the world. To get permission to use more than 200 words of the NIV, we're going to have to go to this man, Rupert Murdoch. He bought the exclusive printing rights to the New International Version. Why would he do that? Why would he be interested in doing something like that? Now, Mike Royko is a columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And he referred to Rupert Murdoch as, and I'm quoting here because I would never call anyone this, he called him a scumbag. And he also called him the Prince of Darkness. Now, there's a book out called Murdoch. It's by a gentleman named Shawcross. And it talks about Mr. Murdoch's plan to control the world. All right? And it shows some of the newspapers and some of the tabloids that he owns, and I wanted to put transparencies up, but quite frankly, they were so rude and crude and horrible that I really didn't feel that I could put them up for anyone to see. But the newspaper that he owned in England was called The Sun, and when he took that over, he turned it 10 times worse than the National Enquirer, and it had photos of nude women all through it and all this sort of thing. Wherever he goes, he just degrades everything, and that's why this unsaved, probably, writer for the Chicago Tribune called him the Prince of Darkness. Now, when he called him the Prince of Darkness, there may be more behind that. This is a photograph that Mr. Murdoch evidently posed for, because you know, when you're just walking through the office and you're in your conference room, you don't look like this. Okay, you don't have a black table with 13 chairs around it. You don't have red lights on you. You don't have your hands holding the whole globe. Okay, this picture was obviously posed. Okay, now as a Christian, would you pose behind a black table with 13 chairs holding the globe like this with red lights on you? I don't think that you would. And so there's a reason why he called him the Prince of Darkness. Every time Mr. Murdoch poses for pictures, he tries to look spooky. I think he might be spooky, I don't know. But anyway, Mr. Murdoch owns Fox Broadcasting, 20th Century Fox Movies, and he's the producer of Bart Simpson. Okay? So those of you who have NIV Bibles, I call them the Bart Simpson Bible, because if you want permission to take 20 minutes out of a Bart Simpson segment, you've got to write to Rupert, and if you want to take more than 200 words from the NIV, you've got to write to Rupert Murdoch. Okay? Now, the editor of the New International Version, the chief editor, has some heretical views about how someone is saved. And so even if we could go into all the world and use an NIV, I don't think anyone would necessarily get saved easily. And here's why. This is what Edwin Palmer said, who's the chief editor of the NIV. He said, "This shows the great error that's so prevalent today in some Orthodox Protestant circles. And that, namely the error that regeneration, that's being born again, depends upon faith. And that in order to be born again, one must first accept Jesus as Savior." Now he's calling this a great error prevalent in Orthodox Protestant circles. Well, now that isn't an error, that's the gospel. Okay, but it isn't the gospel in the NIV. Okay? We have another gospel there. Corinthians says, "If he that cometh preacheth another gospel." The King James says, "Children, how hard it is for them that trust in riches to enter into the kingdom of God." Okay, the New Version say, "Children, how hard it is to enter into the kingdom of God." Can you imagine handing a little child a Bible that said, "Children, how hard it is to enter into the kingdom of God"? That's the last thing one would want to do, because it's easy to be saved. One merely needs to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and thou shalt be saved. Okay? So the gospel is a different gospel there. The New King James changes the gospel also. In Matthew 7, the King James says, "Narrow is the way." Now a sliding board is narrow, but it's the easiest way to get down once you've worked yourself up that into that bad position that we all work ourselves into. Right? It's the easiest way to get down. All right. Going back down the steps is hard. Remember when you're a little kid, someone says, "Come back down, it's too steep." Okay. The New King James says, "Difficult is the way." Now, it's not difficult. Narrow and difficult are not synonyms. Okay. Now, you will find a trend in the New Versions in many cases where salvation by faith, believeth, faith, is changed to obedience, obey. You're not saved, then you're disobeying, okay? The King James will say we have faith. The New Versions, like the New King James or the NIV, will say faithfulness. Okay, I have faith because Jesus is faithful. Okay, I am not always faithful. Now, looking at John chapter 6, verse 47, the King James Bible said, "He that believeth on me hath everlasting life." Jesus says, "I'm the door, I am the way," okay? The New Version simply say, "He that believes has everlasting life." Believes what? Well, you can believe absolutely anything as far as they're concerned, because it doesn't say on me. The key, he's the door. He's the only way in. "He that climbeth up another way is a thief and a robber." But here's it saying you can just climb up about 50 different ways. Okay? The gospel of Christ. And they just simply say the gospel. Okay. They're presenting another doctrine here. The King James is the gospel of Christ, the doctrine of Christ, an heir of God through Christ. They're just simply gospel, doctrine, heir. Matthew 6, the kingdom of God, the spirit of God, the love of God, the angels of God, the gospel, the kingdom of God. This is all heavenly. Okay? This all relates to God. This is all spiritual. The NIV simply says kingdom, spirit, love, angels, gospel. The God is gone. Now, that's not an archaic word, but they want a temporal kingdom down here. They want angels down here. love down here, not the love of God, the Spirit of God. The focus is away from God here. Okay. Now, something as simple as heaven, our hope, which is heaven, is completely eliminated in these new versions in these verses. Our Father who is in heaven, Father which is in heaven, Father who is in heaven, Son of Man which is in heaven. They've taken the Father out of heaven. It's just Father. Okay, now they're going to take the Son out, the Son of Man which is in heaven. It's just Son of Man. They're going to take the angels out, the angels which are in heaven. They're just angels. It's not the kingdom of heaven. It's nothing. The temple is not in heaven anymore. They're going to build the temple. The Masons are going to build the temple for us. It's all on earth, taking our mind off God and heaven.
Gail Ripplinger there, talking about what she found researching her book, New Age Bible Versions, speaking about Rupert Murdoch's new international translation of the Bible, shockingly less accurate than the King James Version, which was translated in Britain in the 17th century. That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Sabine McNeil. Also to the artists Rosa Hewitt and Amy Powell. And you can contact them on 07887 490 484. That's 07887 490 484. Or Rosa Hewitt with two T's, Rosa Hewitt at hotmail.com. Dialect's produced by volunteers. At bristolvolunteers.org.uk is the website. And we'll see you next week. Goodbye for now.
Welcome to International Women's Day special program. Today's program was brought to you by Women's Department of Middle East Radio Project. I'm your host, Mina Sepeer, and with me...
This is Suraya Sayadi.
Hi, Suraya. We are pleased to bring you a very exciting show. We have programs about women in Iraq, Palestine, Kurdistan, and women in Turkey. War affects women more than any other segment in society, and in Iraq this has been more prevalent than any other country in war. The 12 years of criminal sanctions of the U.S. against Iraq took its toll against Iraq's population. Women and children were the first victims and casualties of the sanction. According to the UN report, hundreds of thousands of the population suffered and died. The invasion of U.S. forces with no long-term plans was another criminal act that destroyed what was left of the fabrics of Iraq's society. By destroying all the elements of a democratic society, the governing council is relying on the backward elements of the traditional society. These pre-capitalist forces are imposing their cultural and social values onto the laws that are in the making. Women activists like Yanar Muhammad are fighting the patriarchal culture and also the occupying forces. Passing of Resolution 137 enshrines Islamic Sharia's law into the constitution of Iraq.
This was a concession by Paul Bremer to the backward elements in the Iraq. The international pressure forced the U.S. authorities to repeal Resolution 137. We had an interview with Yanar Mohammed, and since our interview, she had been threatened by fanatics. Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq was formed to support Yanar Mohammed and to put pressure on the U.S. authorities. Today we are going to talk with Huzan Mahmoud, the spokeswoman of that organization. Guest today is Huzan Mahmoud. She speaks for Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. Welcome to our program, Huzan Mahmoud.
Thank you so much.
First of all, I would like you to tell us, please, about the Governing Council Resolution 137 the U.S. government tried to impose on Iraq. What forced them to reconsider this?
Yeah, well, the Resolution 137 is basically proposed by the Governing Council of Iraq, which is about implementing Sharia law in Iraq instead of the previous personal status law. And that has faced a great opposition to it within Iraqi people inside Iraq and outside. There has been lots of campaigning and demonstrations, lectures. I mean, hundreds of people wrote articles in Arabic and English, and they were published on many different websites and newspapers. So there were a huge opposition to implementation of Sharia law in Iraq. And our organization, Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, of course, had a great role in opposing Sharia law in Iraq and abroad as well. We have been campaigning and gathering signatures and holding press conferences and parliament meetings against this resolution, because we know what effects will that have on women's rights and violating their rights, basically. So this great activities of our organization and exposing the dark realities behind Sharia law actually led to the Islamists in Iraq to react in a very terrible way by threatening Yanar Mohammed, who is the head person of our organization, and she is in Iraq. She has been holding lectures to raise awareness, and she had given a speech in a demonstration. The demonstration was actually about representation of women in the governing council, but she had given a speech and she told people what will a representation of women make in the governing council, where the rules and laws are all discriminative against women. And this was broadcasted in all national televisions in Iraq. And then just the day after, the Islamic groups, they are called Jaysh al-Sahaba. They have written her an email, sent her an email, and in the email it said, "We will kill Yanar Mohammed within a few days." So, and this was just basically because Yanar was defending equality and exposing the dark realities behind Sharia law, and she is defending secularism in Iraq as well.
Yeah, and would you please tell us more about Yanar Mohammed and her activities and background?
Yeah. Well, Yanar Mohammed is a very well-known woman rights activist both in Iraq and abroad. She is now one of the international activists, very well regarded in the world for her activism and determinism to change the women's situation in Iraq through the Organization of Women's Freedom. And that OWFI's ideals and Yanar Mohammed herself are being known to people all over the world. And that Yanar is a symbol, or is a leading figure of this movement for equality, freedom, and secularism in Iraq at the moment.
Actually, we had interviewed her in the past, and we're going to air that. Would you please tell us about honor killing in Iraq after U.S. invasion?
Yes. Well, the U.S. invasion led to widespread of terror and violence against women by different groups and families, and it has led to unleash the host of reactionary movements and values in the society. For example, honor killing was among all those violations, because now women are getting raped either by people, Iraqi people, or, you know, just gangsters or whoever, basically. And women are being considered as the honor of the family. And the families, I mean, male members in the family are killing those women who are being raped in order to clear the shame being brought to the family. So it's a daily phenomenon in Iraq that women are being killed for reasons of honor, either suspected or actually being raped by others, or just simply exercising their rights by having sex outside marriage, or falling in love with someone that they want, and stuff like that. So women are, you know, their rights are terribly being violated at the moment, and that honor killing is widespread everywhere.
So apparently the victim is being punished.
Exactly.
Would you please tell us about the safety of women after the invasion?
Well, as I said, this invasion led to lack of security and law and order, and women have no protection and no security at all. There are no institutions or nowhere for women to go to seek protection, for example. And even when they get raped, if they go to hospital, there aren't enough examinations or people, I mean, in the medical, in the clinics or hospitals, basically, to care about these issues. And that so many women actually prefer not to report it, because that will lead to, you know, that will lead them to be killed by either their families or other people, because the situation is so dangerous for them. And they basically have lost every right, even the most basic right, which is the right to life. Because, you know, even when a woman gets raped, still she gets killed. You know, the victim, as you said, is being punished for doing no crimes. And, you know, so simply women have no rights in Iraq at the moment after the invasion.
Would you please tell us about how invasion led to more powerful fundamentalists in Iraq, in a way?
Yeah, well, soon after the collapse of regime, I mean, the dictator regime, all these political groups went back to Iraq, and among them were the Islamic groups, who are mainly funded and ideologically fed by Iran and Saudi Arabia. And we know there is no need for me to repeat what's been happening in Iran and Saudi Arabia in terms of women's rights and how Sharia law works there and public executions and stoning women and all these things. So basically, these Islamic groups just wanted to implement that even without being in power, because first day they went back to Iraq, they were announcing it everywhere that women should be veiled. Women are not allowed to go to work or to study or to even go to attend their exams if they are not veiled, for example. So the veil just became one of the things used against women. I mean, and this is an Islamic way of imposing its values or its rules on people. The first thing is to impose veil on women, and secondly, preventing them from going out or working and stuff like that, because they do consider women as being half-minded and second-class citizens.
Exactly, and maybe as a private property of
exactly,
some people
of
who should be
yes.
who should be protected from yes. outside rather than a independent human
yeah.
being.
So they are just an commodity for men, and that they have no other role in society, just to serve men, and that's it, basically.
Going back to Yanar Mohammadan, would you please tell us about the situation that led to a death threat against her, and what happened?
Yeah, well, as I said, once the ruling council announced Sharia law to be implemented, I mean, our organization has had a very major role inside Iraq and abroad to mobilize the public opinion against this resolution. And Yanar actually had a lecture in Baghdad, and there were media presented, and that she was talking about the negative or destructive role of Sharia law if implemented, as well as she gave a speech in a demonstration against Sharia law, and that was broadcasted in all Iraqi TV channels. So that's basically her activism from a long time ago. I mean, once the regime collapsed, she went back, actually, and she set up Organization of Women's Freedom with other women. And now her activities is very well known in Iraq. And actually, it's met with desires of Iraqi people, and in particular women for freedom. So Yanar has many followers and many people who believe in her ideals. This led to Islamic groups, basically, because they can't do anything. I mean, they cannot communicate or have a dialogue. They just, the only means they have is terror, killings, and you know, and oppression and stuff like that. So that's why she received this email from them. That's when the threat was made, basically, when she was talking so openly against Sharia law.
And what has been the responses of the U.S. authorities toward the death threat against Yanar?
Well, basically, they didn't do anything. Yanar went to them and she reported to them. And up to now, I am kind of sure that they haven't responded in any way, because they simply don't care about what is going to happen in women to happen to women in Iraq or to the majority of people, because they are not there to protect people or to bring freedom for them. They are there for another task, which is to establish new world order and to protect America's interest in Iraq. That's the only task they are there for. I mean, women are being terrorized and they are being killed and they are being raped and kidnapped and sold. Women are being sold in Iraq to neighboring countries, and that they see that on a daily basis, and they are not doing anything about it. So, you know, imagine what would they do in the case of Yanar, specifically, that she's been exposing both Americans and the ruling council and the Islamic groups, I mean political Islam at the same time. So they don't really like people like Yanar.
Our guest today is Huzan Mahmoud. She speaks for Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq. Huzan, what our listener can do to help Yanar's case, and what are your suggestions? Would you please elaborate on that?
Yes. I mean, we have so far have one campaign, but in three different steps. One of them is writing letters of protest to Paul Bremer, and we have all these things on our website.
Website is www.equalityiniraqoneword.com.
And we have also an online petition, I mean, which so far so many people have signed it, and that is, again, with the protest letters and petition online. We will later on gather them and send them to Paul Bremer, as well as we have set up a committee alongside with Maryam Namazi and Nadia Mahmoud. The three of us have established a committee to defend Yanar Mohammed, and we call people to join this committee, basically, if they are members of trade unions or women's organizations, human rights organizations, political parties, whoever they belong to. They can become a member of our committee and take and raise these issues in different places and gather political as well as financial support for Yanar to be protected, and also to raise this issue in the media, which is one of the major issues, that it is important that the whole international public awareness should be raised and should be mobilized against the political Islam and the ruling council and America, basically, because for the miseries they have brought to women in Iraq, and they are not doing anything about it. And that those women who are defending women's rights and are exposing all these brutalities, they are being threatened and they are being faced with death. And Yanar is one of the cases at the moment. And that means that even tomorrow someone else will be threatened. And, you know, it's just the situation is getting worse and worse. And I think your listeners and the whole people who were against the war, and they are, you know, the freedom lovers in the world, they can do change the situation with us. And we need their support in our task, which is basically to achieve equality and freedom for women in Iraq.
You just heard an interview with Huzan Mahmoud. She represents Organization of Women's Freedom in Iraq, and the best way to contact them is by checking their website, www.equalityiniraq.com. They have online petition for the freedom of Yanar Mohammed, and more information can be found there. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
وطني ليس حقيبة يا جرحي المكابر وطني ليس حقيبة.
This is Johaina Marlowe for Voices of the Middle East in a special interview report with Anne Gwynn from Nablus on the plight of Palestinian women suffering under the illegal Israeli occupation. A new United Nations study just published states that Israel's repressive and illegal policies in military and colonial occupied Palestine have had a devastating impact on the lives of Palestinian women and children. Women have been subject to increasing violence by Israeli soldiers and settlers, and they continue to bear a special and enduring burden from the occupation, the UN study states. The tragic suffering of Palestinian women under the occupation continues apace. It is largely ignored by the world and happens beyond the eye of international media. While governments and such well-known NGOs as Amnesty International have been reluctant to heed the call for help in Palestine, one person who has been providing desperately needed assistance to women in the northern Palestinian city of Nablus is Anne Gwynn, co-director of the Mama Group, a grassroots women's organization. The Mama Group works with bereaved mothers and children in Nablus and the surrounding refugee camps, providing a network of support and training for those thousands of women who have lost their brothers, fathers, husbands and sons to Israeli bullets, prisons and so-called targeted assassinations. Anne Gwynn joins us now from London, where she is giving a series of presentations concerning the Palestinian plight before she returns to her home in Nablus. Welcome, Anne, to Voices of the Middle East.
Good morning, Johanna. Good night to you, isn't it? And good morning from London.
Yes, it is. Anne, I've long admired your writings, which have appeared in Counterpunch, the Palestine Chronicle, and other places, and I've been a follower of your many interviews and live reports from Nablus, aired on KPFA's Flashpoints program. We're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you. It's lovely to hear you.
Anne, could you start by telling listeners a little bit about the situation in Nablus currently?
The current situation in Nablus today is that Nablus is now in the second half of the fourth year of almost total closure. That is, total lockdown. Nablus is easy to close. It has it lies on a very flat plain between two precipitous rocky mountains to the north and south. Therefore, it is very simple to close. It can be closed in 10 minutes, unlike any other city in Palestine. The occupation has been particularly brutal in Nablus. Around 650 of its citizens have been murdered, 200 of them women and 100 of them children. Thousands have been arrested, imprisoned and tortured, 190 of them to death by the Israelis. The economy of this huge, formerly powerful, wealthy, beautiful city is almost totally destroyed today. Its current situation is that between 60 and 80% of the people do not have a regular earned income. And if they do have an income, it is one which is at a fraction of the income they had before they were forced into the Intifada in September 2000. For example, people work as a secretary for $100 a month. This is not a third world country. The cost of living there is exactly the same as it is in Britain. In fact, many things are far, far more expensive. Cars, food, petrol, I mean, things are very, very expensive. The result of this total destruction of the economy is of this huge city is, of course, what underpins then all the other things stem from this: the health problems, the lack of education, the suffering, the death. It is, of course, when you destroy the economy, you destroy a city. Nablus is the second oldest continuously inhabited city on the planet. Jesus Christ was here many times. John the Baptist was buried here. His head was buried in Sebastia, a very, very ancient monument indeed, with the most longest colonnaded street surviving. Well, surviving until the Israelis got at it. Now it's destroyed. No one's been allowed to go there for 3.5 years. I have a list of buildings and structures dating from 3,300 years before Christ in and around Nablus, destroyed in their dozens, hundreds and thousands, the total 2,700, a World Heritage Site with 2,700 buildings pulverized by bombs from aircraft, tanks, helicopters, amphitheatres, hippodromes, baths, stairways, the longest in the world with 1,800 steps dating from 5,000 years ago, roads, buildings, barracks, stores, factories, everything. The caravanserai on the Silk Road to the Mediterranean, not only bombed to pieces, but then actually driven over by bulldozers and tanks to make sure. 28 schools destroyed. The new veterinary science building destroyed a week after it opened. The new school of medicine destroyed a week after it opened. Every hospital damaged many times. Every clinic destroyed and looted. Most medical staff and volunteers have been arrested, stripped, beaten, humiliated and imprisoned. Most of the university staff have been imprisoned at some time at least once, and most of the men students. 36 ambulances destroyed. You know, I don't know how to sum this up. 50,000 arrests from the Nablus area alone. One quarter of the whole population, men, women and children, have been arrested and imprisoned at one time or another. Everyone, with very few exceptions, has at least one bullet wound. Many have multiple, 16 to 12. Everyone has lost someone from that family dead. Everyone has someone in the prison. Many families have five in the prison. Everyone has someone dead. The maximum I know is the Alassi family in Balata, who have, I've counted, 15 murdered. I'm not sure if there could be more. 15 of their family members murdered. There are now just the women left, and the women themselves in that family were attacked. It was on the internet, shot, beaten, and thrown in a heap at the bottom of the stairs towards the end of last year. Wow, it's unbelievable. It's the deaths and injuries in Nablus range from 1 to 12 a day dead and 1 to 100 a day injured, depending upon the mood of the Israeli soldiers.
By the waters.
Well, Anne, this is a very bleak picture of this World Heritage Site, Nablus. You alluded to your work with the ambulances, with the Palestinian Medical Relief Committees. The recent UN report mentions that tens of newborn babies and their mothers have died at Zionist checkpoints waiting to pass since June 2003 alone. Can you tell listeners a little about women's health issues and the problems that women routinely face during pregnancy and childbirth?
Yes, I mean, it is one of the most serious health problems that Palestine faces today, all over, of course, but particularly in Nablus and north of Nablus in the governorate, and particularly, of course, in Gaza. Nablus and Gaza's suffering is quite, it's almost indescribable. Every act of violence, every act of deprivation that can be perpetrated against women is by the Israelis. From the denial of food, of vitamins, shiploads of vitamins are destroyed that are sent by the EU. Vaccinations are simply destroyed. They're not allowed in. Cleansers, bleach, antiseptics, blood supplies, every kind of antibiotic would be available but is not allowed, is not permitted to pass checkpoints in order to be at the hospitals and clinics to be given. Women are humiliated, examined. They have to pull their dress up to their breasts to make sure that they are not carrying bombs around their waists.
So there's a terrible humiliation and maltreatment.
The humiliation is unbelievable, Johanna. It's unbelievable. It's so bad that when a woman is bleeding, and it's very clear she's hemorrhaging, we have terrible problems of women bleeding in pregnancy, that the Israeli soldiers, who are very, very prurient, and I know from my direct experience this is not hearsay, I mean, their conversation consists of extremely lewd sexual allusions most of the time. They insist upon lifting up the dress to have a look. And there are, of course, women, but Muslim women are very modest, who say, no, I prefer to die. And they do, often, because they will not allow this. It's clear a woman is pregnant. It's clear the blood is not made up. It's all over the place. And women just bleed to death in the ambulance. They bleed to death standing at checkpoints.
In the US, Anne, we know very little about the alarming level of poverty in many cities in occupied Palestine. Even while we fund the illegal Jewish colonies with our tax dollars, Can you tell us something of the economic situation in Nablus, especially in terms of women?
Yes, I mean, unemployment is absolutely at crisis point, but it's not just unemployment, it's actually all through, it's self-employed as well, because 270 factories, for example, have been destroyed. The whole city hall, the governorate headquarters, the Mahafada, was totally destroyed, of course, with all its jobs. It now uses a very small temporary building for the past, since April 2002, for nearly 2 years. Most people, as I said, between 60 and 80% have no real earned income, even if you take it as being 60% are actually unemployed. Another 20% who are nominally employed really have no income to speak of. A doctor, for example, earns $650 a month, a young doctor. A doctor who is a director or a manager of an organization like UPMRC would earn perhaps $1,500 a month. We are talking here of a place where it is as expensive to live as it is in the UK. People working as secretaries for $100 a month, people working as personal assistants to very high-powered industrialists formerly, like the Abdelhadis or the Turkan family, earning now $300 a month. This means that malnutrition levels, of course, are rising actually weekly. And we now have 26,000, or around 26,000 families who are dependent on UN food program handouts. Sounds okay, UN food program handouts, nice little food parcels. Unfortunately, the Israelis do not, mostly now, do not allow the trucks through Huwara to bring the food supplies. So it's intermittent, it's irregular, no one knows what will come. It's very basic stuff anyway. It's flour, rice, white flour, of course, from Europe, our surpluses, paid for by the UN food program, bottles of olive oil, of which we have millions and millions that can't be bought in the Nablus governorate because people have no money, but we sell our surplus from Europe, from the southern European countries, Greece, Italy, and Spain, to be shipped at great cost, sorted, bottled, administered, shipped, landed, transported, and distributed to people who are living within 2 kilometers of millions of bottles of absolutely wonderful olive oil. The result of the malnutrition is twofold. The children and the women, everyone suffers from malnutrition now, to some degree, except the few who are still surviving for one reason or another, is severe anemia. 60% of pregnant women have what is now described as severe anemia, with horrible consequences for her and for her baby. And 70% of children suffer from severe anemia, which leads to nearly 10% of children being born with mental retardation. In what was formerly a very healthy population. We're not talking about some sort of third world country here. Not that it would be right to treat anyone wherever they are like this, but this was a modern, powerful, educated center of excellence in education with 6 huge regional hospitals specializing in women's treatment, in fertility, in every kind of pediatrics, cardiac specializations, dialysis, diabetes centers. This is not somewhere that has always been poor and in the dust. This is an extremely wealthy city reduced to rubble. And, of course, this health, the problems of malnutrition, there are more ways than one of causing the genocide of a people. You don't actually have to simply shoot them. If you cause their health to be so bad that their babies are stillborn or born with problems, that they have terrible fertility problems, that the mothers themselves die. Many mothers bleed throughout pregnancy. We have a lot of problems of mothers just bleeding endlessly throughout the pregnancy. They cannot reach a hospital. They cannot reach treatment. They cannot have antenatal treatment. Eventually, of course, this is a kind of genocide too. You don't have to shoot them, but they die no less as a result of Israeli brutality.
Yes, indeed.
It's horrible. Formerly, people used to visit their antenatal clinic 9 times a year. Sorry, 9 times in the pregnancy, or 9 times a year it is. And now we're very fortunate. I was told by Dr. Hala Hassan, she is one of the 12 women gynecologists and obstetricians in Nablus working against all the odds to try to enter the closed villages and try to bring some help to the women. She said, we are lucky now if we see them three times during the pregnancy, and it often can be once only. And even if they need some drugs, they can't afford them. I mean, anemia is so easy to treat. It's so easy. Their levels of hemoglobin are so low, it's kind of off the scale in Europe and American standard.
We are speaking with Anne Gwynn, co-director of the MAMA Project, a grassroots women's organization based in the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Anne, the work you do together with Nablusi women as part of the MAMA group is invaluable and obviously desperately needed. I understand you're currently raising money to fund a mother and child center in Nablus. What does the MAMA group hope to achieve in its work with and for the women of the Nablus governorate?
The MAMA project grew out of discussions with the bereaved, deprived, and, well, desperately poor women in Bolota refugee camp and in the old city of Nablus, two particularly hard-hit targets of the Israeli brutality. It wasn't my idea, it was theirs. It's a project which is designed to bring, I think, really most important, hope where today there is none. Training, education, refine the skills which they already have. It'll be a center where women, bereaved women whose husbands have been lost to disability, because they're no less lost if they're in bed paralyzed for 3.5 years as though they were dead. It's actually in a way much worse. Women whose men have been lost to disability, death, 700-year sentences in the Israeli prisons, where they can train on computers, IT, just using computers, not just IT, but simpler things, embroidery, childcare, teaching, spoken English, written English, so they can communicate with the media. Any training that our volunteers can offer will be offered at the MAMA Center. And there will be there a kindergarten where the mothers can leave their children, you know, with a peaceful mind, knowing that they are not at that time on the street and likely to get shot by a passing Jeep or passing Hummer. I was shocked in California in the summer to see Hummers driven by civilians going on holiday. Every Hummer I've seen has shot at least one child dead. Soldiers in every Hummer. The MAMA Center, its prime purpose is, its economic purpose is training and bringing together of women's skills to benefit them and their families, and then, of course, the destroyed economy of Nablus, but also to bring hope and to give some play experience to children who have no play. Just think about it. And I talked to my friend Tahrir Raisa last night, and she's 24. She has been a widow since she was 22 after 4 months of marriage. It was her idea, actually, the MAMA. She was the prime mover behind it. She said, you know, I really want to have my childhood now because I never have one. I want to do those things where you laugh and do silly things, things that have no purpose. Just enjoy yourself.
Yes. And people here in the US often have misconceptions about Islam and Muslim women, which are fed by films or by mainstream news reports showing erroneous Orientalist images of Muslims and sometimes Palestinians.
The first time I'd realized that ever since I started going to, I'm 65 now, when I started going to children's matinee, it was called then, films, that from that time, from about the age of 7, of course, I had also absorbed all this propaganda, and it was just a revelation to see the quality of interpersonal life between Muslim women in Palestine and their husbands and their fathers and their sons. far from being repressed, they have long passed our level of equality, which is nominal, strident, and has to be emphasized all the time in order for us to believe that we are equal. I think one of my daughters said to me one day, looking at the Oscar ceremonies in Hollywood, women will never be equal to men, while men are in elegant dinner suits and women are in clothes that barely cover anything. In Nablus, women are equal. They look at men as equals. They don't flirt all the time. Every relationship isn't based on some imagined sexual attraction. They are 56 or 55% of students in the universities. They are 55% of the bank and insurance employees. They're in every field. It's not just that they are in every field, like pharmacy and medicine and banking and store owners, business women in the media. They're in every field. It's the fact that they're equal in these fields. No one says, look, we have women working here. It's just normal that women are educated and equal and carry equal weight in the family. It's just a normal thing. It's very difficult to describe. It's like not remembering what color someone's eyes are. You know, it's not a thing you particularly notice that women are equal. It's been amazing. It's been an amazing insight. I don't know whether you think this. One of the biggest misconceptions, of course, is this so-called, I have to put it in mental quotes, headscarf, the hijab. The hijab is not a headscarf, like the Queen of England wears a headscarf to watch the three-day horse trials in badminton. It's not a headscarf. It's a hijab. It's a modest thing, together with its jilbab, which is a long, elegant, very gently swishing coat, which Nablus women wear with high-heeled boots or high-heeled sandals in the summer, as they walk elegantly, very straight down the street, like Indian women. All women who wear long clothes, of course, have to walk elegantly. It's their choice. It's not forced upon them. It's beautiful. It's elegant. To see any picture, to see a graduation in An-Najah University in Nablus, especially in the summer when they wear what is called a beya, which is not a jilbab, it's a very, very filmy, beautiful, like a chiffon-y long coat. I mean, who would choose to wear a mini skirt which barely covers anything when you could dress like this? I mean, the elegance, the beauty is absolutely mind-blowing. And it's their choice. When I go to any home, the first thing any young woman will say to me is, you want to try on hijab? And everybody wants me to try it on and wear it. They wear it with such pride. And when I had a discussion with a manager of a hotel, Raed Mohsen, really an amazing man. I know this program's about women, but the men that are pretty amazing too. He said, Anne, I mean, what do you think they wear our women wear under jilbab? You think they wear some dowdy things? No, no, he said. They wear extremely sexy clothes under jilbab. And of course, when I started visiting and living in homes, yes, they do. When they go in through the door, they then become the beautiful, sexy woman that their husband met and married, but they do not wish to flaunt it in the street. This is their choice.
And Anne, you mentioned that over half of the student body at An-Najah National University in Nablus is made up of women. How have the constant closures, lockdowns and curfews affected women's ability to continue their education at places like An-Najah? Only 2 months ago, Anne, we heard the tragic story of Kamel, a young mother who was shot at a checkpoint on her way to class to An-Najah.
Oh, yes, this is normal. I mean, to be shot at checkpoints, this is normal. I mean, nearly 100 students of An-Najah have been killed on their way to classes, as well as, of course, hundreds of school children. But students are a particular target. The continual closures of Nablus, which mean they cannot cross a checkpoint. Closure is a very difficult concept for us to grasp, really. I don't know how anyone can grasp it unless you've been there. I mean, nothing goes in and nothing comes out. So
women for 3 months at a time have to live in Nablus because they cannot return to their villages. A huge amount of the student body is from the surrounding governorate. Nablus is one-third or less than one-third of the governorate population, and An-Najjar serves the whole governorate, so probably something like two-thirds of the students come from outside. Now, they can't just kip down like British students or American students might on the floor of a friend, because this is a traditional society, and women, you know, there are standards of behaviour which are expected. Women can't just kip down with a load of men and women students. So they, are, of course, have to have special hostels, or they stay in hotels who do a cheap rate for them. But it costs them about $20 a night to stay. And sometimes they have to stay for months at a time. Particularly they target finals time. Universities are closed for 3 months over the last semester, usually to try and prevent people doing their finals. In fact, what this does lead to is very, very, very strong women who are determined to be educated, right from the time of going to school. There's no way you're going to deter these women from education. So far from stopping people getting educated, it leads to a really steely resolve, you know, to fight for Palestine through education, through knowledge, through taking their place in the world and being spokespersons for Palestine in the future.
And finally, Anne, we're beginning to hear of some cases of horrific torture by Israelis of Palestinian women held illegally in Zionist prisons. Do you have anything to tell us about that?
Oh, indeed I do. I know some 14 women prisoners. 13 from, 7 from Balata, 6 from Nablus, and one who is, I believe, Johanna, you know, George Ibrahim, the very famous director and film actor, director of Al-Kasaba Theatre.
Yes.
Know George. Well, George is a Christian Palestinian. His daughter, 10 jeeps, swept up to her Quaker, American Quaker school in Ramallah, 10 jeeps. 50 Israeli soldiers went inside and abducted her. She was 16. She was taken for 3 months without any information whatsoever as to her whereabouts. She eventually got a 3-year sentence for nothing. We don't know what it was for. And eventually she was actually, I spoke to George three weeks ago, and she was actually recently released. And I said to him, how is she? And he said, which was a stupid question. He said, 1 year in Israeli jail. And that's all he said. They are raped. Prisoners are raped. They are gassed. They have boiling water thrown over them. They are deprived of food. They are beaten. They are shackled to their beds. They are shackled and their mouths are held open, and poisonous gases are sprayed from aerosols down their throats. They are humiliated. They live in cold cells without heating, without window, without air, with one blanket through the viciously cold winters. Every kind of torture and ill-treatment, they are forced into uncomfortable, in ridiculous positions for hours at a time till every nerve and sinew screams with pain. They are beaten until they are insensible. Then the doctors, who are party to this torture, say stop because she will die. Leave her to recover, then you can beat her again. This is torture which is illegal under any regime, even for people who have done something. These are women who are simply arrested because mostly to try to put pressure on the men, actually. Most of this ill-treatment is to try to put pressure on men to confess to things they haven't done. It's an outrage. It really is. I called in Amnesty International in London last week, and they could find nothing. Nobody in the office, 5 people, could find anything relating to Palestine. There are 8,000 prisoners in Palestine. 200 of them are women. And there's 200 or 400 women and 200 children. It's hundreds anyway. None of them have done anything. The figures blow your mind. You know, it's very difficult to keep them in your head.
Yes, women like, I believe, Amina Muna, who is undergoing some of these horrific tortures that you have been telling us about.
Amna Mona is just one of the world's most amazing people. Isn't it amazing where film after film was made about French resistance workers like Odette? I mean, everyone in Britain of my age knows the name Odette. everyone in the world should know the name of Amna Mona, because, you know, she is such an inspiration to women everywhere. Despite the worst of all the torture, she still remains an inspiration to all the other women prisoners. She's their comfort, their succor, their confidant. She's the one who keeps them alive, keeps hope going, and she's only in her 20s herself, like Odette, a very great French resistance worker.
Well, Anne Gwynn, thank you so very much for talking with us, Voices for the Middle East on KPFA. How could listeners get hold of you, Anne, if they'd like to email you?
I love to receive, you know, letters on my email from people who listen or read about Nablus, because this is not my story. This is the story of Nablus. I have an email which is specially for this purpose, and it's my surname first, Gwyn. It's a very old Welsh family name. It's spelled G-W-Y-N-N-E underscore Ann with an E, A-N-N-E, at hotmail.com. Please write to me and let me know what you think. If you want information, I will give you a website that you can click on to get it. Don't feel, please feel totally free to write to me. I love it. Love to have your letters.
Thanks very much, Anne Gwynn. Listeners interested in contacting Anne or visiting her webpage, or listeners interested in helping Anne's work in Nablus or donating to MAMA, should visit our webpage. That's www.me-radio.org. Thanks very much, Anne Gwynn. We wish you a safe return to Nablus.
Oh, there is nothing I wish more, Johanna. Thank you.
Imagine the nightmare of being locked away in a dark, filthy cell. No one knows you are there. You cry out, but the silence is deafening. You are helpless, terrified, and utterly alone. As you well know, for thousands of women and men and children around the world, this is no dream. It's too real. They are literally wasting away in a jail. Many are beaten and tortured. They are imprisoned because of what they believe, what they think, what they've said, or simply who they are. The women in Kurdistan of Turkey are facing a twofold struggle, one against the state terrorism and then against patriarchal traditions. We have the case Leyla Zana, whose excerpts from her letters will be read.
In the Republic of Turkey, Kurds are subjected to a policy of forceful yet legal assimilation. In Turkey, the legal Kurdish struggle for political rights has been blocked, forcing many Kurds to join the armed struggle unfolding in the mountains of Kurdistan. Leyla Zana is one of the women who joined the struggle against patriarchal traditions and state terrorism. Her personal development was virtually synonymous with the development of the Kurdish liberation struggle, and this culminated with her candidacy for parliament in the 1991 elections. Leyla Zana was the first Kurdish woman ever elected to the Turkish parliament. She received 45,000 votes in her district in Diyarbakir, more than any other candidate. After her election, she moved to Ankara. Her incredible energy and courageous actions on behalf of the 16 million Kurds in Turkey made her famous throughout the entire country. A hunger strike to protest army attacks on the Kurdish New Year festival, Nevruz, funeral march for a leading Kurdish politician whose murdered body had been found near a beach, countless visits to families who had been victims of state violence and who had been deprived of their means for existence. A close examination reveals that the life and personal development of Leyla Zana closely mirrors that of the uprising of the Kurdish people, a sort of microcosm of the entire Kurdish resistance movement. As a woman, she stood her ground against sexist attitudes and degrading traditions.
Shut up, woman. What woman has never heard that order from a husband, father, or brother personifying domestic power? In a meeting of my party's parliamentary group, one member of parliament, known as a Democrat and a progressive, cut me off, saying I should let the men speak first, as is our good old patriarchal tradition. I was dumbstruck. I had to explain calmly that I had been elected with nearly twice the number of votes he had, and that the voters had chosen me so that I would speak out and express their suffering and their wishes in the parliament, in the media, and before an international audience, and that furthermore, I had as much right to speak as anyone else. He apologized for his attitude, the effect of age-old habits, and no one in my party had ever again dared interrupt me or claim male privilege. The tendency was even reversed. My colleagues always wanted me to be first to express myself, which I also refused. I wanted to be considered a human being in my own right, to express myself on equal basis with men. It took time for my friends in the party to put the concept of equality into practice, but they finally got used to it. In Parliament, there were only 8 women out of 450 members, as I was the only Kurdish woman. Attempts to engage my Turkish women colleagues in dialogue were unsuccessful, probably because of nationalist prejudice. Also, I think each was the protege of some clique or faction, and they feared for their careers. For fear of displeasing the powerful men, they almost never spoke and were content to be bit players. The first time I spoke in Parliament was when I took the oath of office. I had to swear under the Constitution, solemnly swear, to respect the principles of that anti-democratic document written and imposed by the 1980 military junta. It was all the more painful because the Constitution legitimizes a particularly repressive military coup d'etat that established Turkish nationalism and Atatürk's no less nationalist principles as official state ideology. It codified into law the negation of Kurdish people and criminalized any affirmation of Kurdish identity. In sum, the Turkish political military establishment asked us, the elected representative of Kurdish people, to publicly renounce our identity, the reason d'etre of our democratic struggle, and to pledge our allegiance to its system. Without that public, televised act of allegiance, our mandate as member of parliament would not be validated.
In a letter to Berna Yilmaz, the wife of the Prime Minister in 1998, Leyla Zana underlines how social status and class differences distinguish the struggle of disposed women from those of the ruling class.
There are mothers in Turkey. Forget about being able to be with their children. Do not even know where they are. They cannot reach them, embrace them, smell them, or touch them. They do not even have a gravesite for them, a place this mother could shed their tears. These mothers for years now, every Saturday, meet in front of Galatasaray High School at noon, with pictures of their loved ones in their hands. They want to share their pain by means of peaceful sit-ins. They do not loiter, they do not block the traffic, and they do not attack the spectators. They want to sit there in front of that high school to voice their deadening silence about their losses. The names of their loved ones were Mehmet, Hassan, Yavuz, Aysel, and Savas at one time. But they all have one name now, disappeared ones. The name of the mothers are Emin, Isma, Yildiz, and Pervin. Now they have one name as well. the Mothers of Disappeared Ones, or Saturday Mothers. Do you know what is happening to them for weeks now? Elite police force, with their batons, shields, and guns, accompanied with sounds of siren, attack these mothers, pull their hairs, haul their bodies, and beat their torsos, subject them to pressurized water, and force them to board the waiting buses for police stations. They are then kept for a few days and then released. These mothers gather in front of that high school for what they feel in their hearts. Will they ever stop coming? Dauntlessly, they come back. Their crime is to be Saturday mothers. Their crime is to love their sons and daughters. You are a mother and they are mothers. You have a son named Hassan and another Yavuz. They had sons at one time. You love your children. These mothers are even denied opportunity to express their love for their children.
In a world of global capitalism, the struggles and tactics of women and other disposed people share more similarities. The Saturday Mothers in Turkey is a reminder of Mothers in Black of Argentina. Thus, it is not surprising to witness that the fight against political Islam and religious fanaticism in the Middle East are common among the countries of the region. Leila Zana's letter to Taslima Nasreen, the famous Bangladeshi doctor and writer who has been under a death threat from Islamic fanatics, shows the common struggle of women for equality.
In our societies, divided by religious and national differences, the true emancipation of women does not seem possible except in the framework of pluralistic, secular democracy. Let us give believers freedom of conscience and create structures that guarantee that the freedom without allowing anyone to impose his or her beliefs on others. In such a framework, our emancipation can be achieved only through education, culture, work, and daily struggle against sexist discrimination. We must teach our children, brothers, husbands, and fathers that the development of each of us requires respect for the other and the equality of the sexes. In Muslim societies, shaped by centers of patriarchal tradition, the struggle will be particularly difficult. The pioneers will suffer and have to put up with all kinds of insults and ordeals. By fighting for emancipation of women, we will bring an essential contribution to the struggle for democracy from Algeria to Bangladesh.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Loss of West Antarctic Glaciers. Interview with Eric Vigneault, Professor of Earth System Science at UC Irvine and glaciologist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena. If a country like France were to lose its coastline by up to 1.5 miles each year, the world would be alarmed. When an ice mass in the Antarctic, almost the size of France, continues to lose the ocean-facing edges of its glaciers by up to 1.5 miles a year, there's still silence. Scientists said at a NASA press conference on May 12, 2014, that this process has actually begun. And it is just a question of time, whether it will take 100 years, 200 years or more, or much less to complete. A new study based on real data, not computer models, finds a rapidly melting section of the West Antarctic ice sheet appears to be in an irreversible state of decline. the Pine Island, Thwaites, and four other glaciers contain enough ice to raise global sea level by 4 feet. And they're melting faster than most scientists had expected. The information presented by Eric Rignot, glaciologist with NASA and professor of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine, and his colleague, Professor Sridhar Anandakrishnan, glaciologist at Penn State, was registered with surprise, shock, and the usual loud voices of denial. This was the opening of a TUC radio program broadcast in June 2014. I decided on a rebroadcast in September 2015 in preparation of an update on sea level rise and ice cap melting, not just in Antarctica, but also in Greenland. My interview with Professor Eric Rignot seemed like a perfect introduction to the science and the data involved. It also shows so well the personal challenges for those who work on this difficult and often dangerous task. Here's the rest of the introduction. The Amundsen Sea embayment, with its 5 glaciers, is one of the hardest-to-reach areas of West Antarctica. In both directions, it is far from any established research station. To this day, you can name the few courageous scientists who have actually set foot on it. It is at the outer limits of the reach of airplanes that might attempt to fly in from Chile or New Zealand. Research vessels run the risk of getting stuck in sea ice. Nevertheless, all data collected for the last 50-plus years show an ever-growing element of danger. With the beginning of the age of satellites run by NASA and the European Space Agency, and exact mapping of the topography of the Amundsen Sea embayment, new data on the thickness and flow speeds of the glaciers, water temperatures, and wind all delivered the proof that a huge melt is underway in the area. And here today is my phone interview of Professor Rignot. Rignot is not only a NASA glaciologist and Earth System Science professor, he's also a leading voice in the new discipline of remote sensing science, using both airplanes and satellites. The first time Rignot saw the Pine Island Glacier with his own eyes, he was deeply moved. For years, he had logged its movement with satellites. Now he was on a research plane flown by the Chilean Navy, collecting data from as low as 400 meters above the surface. NASA, in this case, had expressed concern that such a difficult mission was even possible. Nevertheless, the plane took off with Rignot on board. The year was 2002.
It was actually quite an amazing experience, because when we set up to do this experiment with NASA and our partners in Chile, a lot of people thought it was not possible to reach this sector. Starting from Punta Arenas in Chile, fly all the way to that part of West Antarctica, collect some data, and fly back. We did it. It was kind of a game changer for looking at this area. It showed it was possible to do this. And it was actually the first time I could set my eyes on the real thing, those big glaciers. It was kind of a humbling experience, because you really realize how gigantic these glaciers are. They are by no means similar to the glaciers that most of us are familiar with in the mountainous regions. They are enormous pieces of land ice flowing slowly in the ocean, 30 kilometers wide for Pine Island and 120 kilometers wide for Thwaites. So you can imagine, when you fly over these entities, it takes many minutes to fly across them, and you really size the magnitude of this area then.
So you're saying it was not clear this could actually be done, and it hadn't been done before, at least not at the altitude you were flying at?
The way this was done, we took off from Punta Arenas, and then you have to fly at high altitude so you don't use as much fuel. And then you dive down towards the West Antarctic part we were interested in to collect data. According to the calculations prior to flight, we had enough fuel to get there, collect data for 2 hours, and then fly back. I remember on the way there, the winds were in the wrong directions, and it looked like by the time we get there, we'll have to turn back and collect no data. But then the wind worked in our favor, and we were able to collect 2 hours of data for the first time, including laser altimetry, radar sounder to measure the ice thickness. And this was the first time we could collect extensive data over this area. It's just 2002, it's not very long ago. And another difficulty of doing this back then was we did not have a very good weather forecast of the conditions in West Antarctica. So it's kind of a big gamble to take the airplane, fly all the way down there, and find that the weather is not good. Bob Thomas was the leader of his whole experiment, and on one day kind of took a risk looking at the weather predictions from this center in the U.S. He had a feeling that we had a shot at it, and it turned out to be right, but it was a little bit of a gamble. Nowadays, when they fly there, first of all, they know it's possible to do it, but also the weather prediction for these parts of the Antarctic have improved tremendously. So actually, before they take off, they have a fairly good idea what weather they're going to encounter going there and what the weather is going to be like in Antarctica, where the clouds are, and if it's going to be an impact on the measurements or not.
Now, there is actually another scientist who has done field work, or do you call it something else when it's on ice, field work on the Thwaites Glacier?
The first people who actually did field work there, they were there in the late 50s and 60s. They were part of the International Geophysical Year, the IGY. Charlie Bentley did some seismic work there that was a breakthrough experiment because it revealed for the first time how deep these glaciers were. John Baring did a traverse of Thwaites Glacier and collected gravity data and the best altimetry data they could do at the time. These were the pioneer. Then they had to wait until 1981 before another team set foot on the Pine Island Glacier, led by Terry Hughes and others. And it was not until fairly recently when a team led by Bob Binchadler, I think around 2011 or 2012, set foot on the glacier, on Pine Island Glacier again, to drill for the ice shelf. And a team also from Penn State, led by Sridhar Anandakrishnan, to do seismic work on the Thwaites. They started around 2010, 2011, I think. So you see that all these in-situ experiments are kind of fairly recent.
That's NASA glaciologist Professor Eric Vigneault. In 1957, Charlie Bentley's team had to unroll hundreds of meters of cable outfitted with geophones and set off explosives that sent sound waves down to the base of the ice sheet. This is how they were able to measure the ice thickness at that time. Things became much easier with the beginning of the age of satellites.
We saw that to wait until we had new technology to look at this. And the big change in our ability to look at this area came from satellites. This part of West Antarctica is the most remote from all the manned stations in the Antarctic. That's why a lot of the U.S.-led effort is focused more on the Ross Ice Shelf next to the McMurdo Station. And a lot of the European efforts are focused on the other ice shelf, the Fjellstavrani, where they have manned stations. And Pine Island Thwaites is right in the middle, the farthest away from any station. It's difficult to reach by plane, impossible by foot. So the fact that starting in the early 1990s, we could get regular satellite images, especially radar that go through the clouds, of this area was a game changer. It took a little while, but in the mid-90s, using some of the ERS data from the European Space Agency, we found that the grounding line of Pine Island Glacier was retreating very fast. The grounding line is where the glacier becomes afloat in the ocean and detaches from the bed. We don't see it at the surface because it's hidden by kilometers of ice. Because when these glaciers reach the ocean, they become afloat in the ocean. So that transition boundary where the glacier detaches from the bed is not visible. It's hidden by all the floating ice. So we used some radar interferometry techniques that measured very precisely the subtle motion of the ice up and down with changes in oceanic tide to delineate exactly where that transition boundary was. And at the time, I was kind of experimenting with these techniques, and Pioneer Glacier was one place where I thought it would be interesting to experiment. And in 1997, I realized that this glacier was retreating a kilometer per year, which was a huge number. I had not seen that anywhere else we've been looking at. And that was the first indication that something big was going on in that area. And since that, we've accumulated information from satellites that measure the speed of the glacier, measure the evolution of the surface, which is an indication of the changes in volume of the ice, changes in the gravity field that indicate the changes in mass of the glacier. And we've basically been able to continue these observations for the past 20 years. So I think initially the results we got were a big surprise to a lot of people. But when you see such big changes, you really need to take a closer look at it and see what it means on the long term, which is probably why it took so long for us to sit down and decide, look, people, I think we've looked at this area long enough. We've got enough evidence to say that there is something major going on in there. Very important part of looking at this glacier besides satellites has been an international effort to gather more data about the configuration of the bed in this sector. I mentioned that we did get some measurements in the 60s through rather heroic traverses at the time with tractors and camps. You know, that took a couple of years to complete. But we needed more than that. We needed more detail to fill in a lot of the gaps in between. And this was done in 2002 with the Chilean. We started it, and then in 2004, it was a large-scale experiment involving the British Antarctic Survey and the University of Texas in Austin to map the whole sector. Since then, in 2009, NASA has flown the Ice Bridge mission, which is also an airborne program, that collected even more data on this sector, which is why 2014, we reached the point where we map the critical sectors of this part of West Antarctica so well, we could come to the definite conclusion that these glaciers are retreating right now through these deep valleys, which have no mountains or no hills in the back. There's nothing that's going to stop the retreat of these glaciers. We really check the whole area through.
It seems really important to look at the definition of grounding line and the discovery, how to actually pinpoint where it is. And I wondered who first coined that term and who first invented a procedure to be able to tell from the air, from the surface, where the grounding line would be, so miles deep in some places under the ice.
The technique that we used to look at the grounding line was sort of invented at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory back in the 80s. The concept of interferometry was first tested in the 70s on airborne platforms, but using this data to look at fine-scale motion of the surface comes back to the late 80s from people like Richard Goldstein at JPL. Richard showed very early on in the ERS mission that this sort of technique was very useful for glaciology. He published a paper in 93 on the Rutherford Glacier that showed that you could see the motion of the ice, you could see the transition to flotation, but he had very little data. And after that, we actually showed that there was a more precise way to map the grounding line using multiple radar images of the same area and doing a more complex analysis So actually, I pioneered that technique, and we started to apply it in a number of regions, and that's when I stumbled on the Pine Island Glacier, which I had heard about from the work of Terry Hughes and Bob Thomas and others, and also because just a year earlier, Stan Jacobs and Adrian Jenkins came back from a ship expedition, the first one that came to Pine Island Bay, where they reported that the subsurface water were unusually warm, and this revealed for the first time that there was circumpolar deep water in that area, which must play an important role in the evolution of the glaciers in this part of Antarctica.
Could you say a little more about how you pioneered that technique? Because I suspected you had discovered something that you should be credited with.
I mentioned Rick Goldstein, who was the first to show the difference in motion between land ice and floating ice. He was the first to show an interferogram, a combination of radar images using this interferometry technique that showed the very subtle motion of the ice over a period of a few days. So the way it works, this radar interferometry technique works, is that it detects the motion of the surface through repeated measurements with a precision that scales with the wavelength of the radar. The wavelength of the radar is about 5.6 centimeters, so you detect motion of the surface within millimeters from space with this technique. A little bit similar to what we would obtain if we could deploy millions of GPS receivers on the ice surface and monitor the signal over time. Except here we come back every once in a while, take a new measurement, and do some differencing with the previous measurement to measure the motion within millimeters. So wherever the glacier is afloat, it's going to move up and down by a meter or so during the tidal cycle. And on the grounded ice, it's not going to move at all. So we can map that transition boundary very well because we can detect the motion of the surface within millimeters. And it's an amazing technique. We're very fortunate to be able to use that technique on the glaciers and look at this level of detail, millimeters. I think we've shown, in fact, at the time, that even if you put GPS receivers on the surface, interferometry was capable of doing things even 10 times better. Which means that we could delineate the precise position of that grounding line 10 times better than any other instrument in existence.
And all that is the background to your statement that these glaciers have passed the point of no return. How does that get expressed in sea level rise over time?
So we stated that they passed the point of no return because we have 40 years of observation that these glaciers are all speeding up at the same time, and the change in speed is felt hundreds of kilometers inland. It's not just a little coastal disturbance. It's affecting the whole glacier system. We have 20 years of observations that the grounding line of this glacier is retreating very fast, kilometer per year, in some places 2 kilometers per year. It was not just a little bump in the system. It's been doing that for 20 years consistently. And then we have a very detailed mapping of the bed that shows, indeed, all these glaciers are flowing through very narrow, deep valleys that get deeper inland, and this is conducive to faster retreat. So it's kind of the ensemble of all these observations that justify that we can say these glaciers are retreating. This is not a prediction. This is what's happening now. This is what has been going on for 20 years and will continue for decades because there's nothing in the system to stop it. We had to understand a little bit what was driving all of this, which was not an easy thing to do. It was very obvious from the beginning that the presence of warm water was a big part of what was happening to these glaciers. These floating extensions were thinning, the grounding line was retreating, there were very high melt rate in the ocean. But it was only rather recently that it became clear that the transport of this warm water towards the glacier is controlled by the wind regime around the Antarctic, and that wind regime has changed, and the winds have strengthened, which sends the subsurface water more easily towards the glacier. And the strengthening of this wind is related to two things, global warming and to the depletion of the ozone in the Antarctic. with the result that Antarctica is not warming as fast as the rest of the globe. And simple physics tell you in that case, when the globe is warming faster than the Antarctic, the wind around the Antarctic continent are going to get stronger. And there was a paper actually reaffirming that with even better data, just at the same time we did our press conference, which showed that the winds have been the most extreme in the past 1,000 years, and they really started to accelerate in the 70s, and that it's directly related to climate warming.
The one question that was addressed in the conference that everybody wants to know, how soon will this play out in sea level rise?
Oh, yes. Yes. So there's enough ice in that sector of Antarctica to raise global sea level by 1.2 meters. So if we melt all this ice into the ocean, global sea level will rise by 1.2 meter on average. We know that if all this ice in that part of West Antarctica goes away, it will trigger the retreat of the rest of West Antarctica. And that's a 3 to 5 meter global sea level equivalent if all that ice in West Antarctica goes to sea. This is going to take a while. At the rate at which these glaciers are retreating right now, it will take a century or two before a major portion of that ice is removed from the Pine Island Tweed Basin. But we have all reasons to believe that as the glaciers retreat farther inland into deeper ice, the retreat rate will actually accelerate. It will not maintain it. It will not slow down. So it's difficult to extrapolate, and there's been always a difficult thing to put a time scale on this. We have to appreciate the fact that these glaciers are evolving much faster than any numerical model has been able to predict. So our numerical models are a little bit inept and not capable of replicating some of these fast changes. They're making progress, but they are trailing behind all our observations. And they tend to produce results that are too conservative because they don't have all the physics and all the interaction in them. So I think it's reasonable to think that a lot of the ice in that sector is going to be removed in the coming 1 or 2 century. And it will largely depend on the rate of warming of the climate. It's pretty clear that if we continue warming the planet at this rate, the retreat of ice in that sector of Antarctica will only speed up. How much will it speed up is very difficult to tell, but it will speed up. Can we stop it? That was a question that was asked by a lot of people, and my answer was, I don't think so. I think we passed the point of no return. We cannot stop these glaciers from retreating unless we could cool back down the climate back to the 70s, which is practically impossible to do. And even then, it's not clear that the glaciers would stop the retreat. They are following a series of processes right now that is kind of unstoppable. What we could do is certainly slow down the rate of the retreat somehow if climate stops warming or even goes back to something a little bit cooler from the past.
So we'll see this as an opportunity.
There is an opportunity. There's also a bigger opportunity to realize that, like my colleague Richard Alley says, we kind of blew up a fuse in one part of Antarctica, but there's a lot more fuses. There are a lot more areas around the Antarctic that are in a configuration close to what we have in Pine Island Thwaites. It's a little bit more difficult for warm waters to get there on some of these glaciers, but I think in particular about the Totem Glacier in East Antarctica, which contains a 7 meter global sea level equivalent, a single glacier. Disappearance to sea would raise global sea level by 7 meters. We have data on this glacier that suggests that it's already being teased. It's already going through some phases that could be precursive to a rapid retreat. So it's clear to me that as the climate system continues to go into the direction it's going right now, there could be other sectors of the Antarctic picking up speed and starting disintegration. And we have to keep that in mind. Pine Island and Thwaites is not the only place. There are other big giants in the Antarctic that are dormant right now, but it seems that we're working really hard to wake them up.
Thank you so much. What a heavy burden to carry. I wish you well.
Thank you very much.
And I congratulate you on your work and your courage to stand out there and say what you found.
Thank you very much. I'm 20 years older now, so that's where the courage comes from. Thank you, Maria.
All my best. Bye-bye.
You heard the rebroadcast of an interview with Eric Rignot, recorded in May 2014. Rignot is glaciologist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, and he's professor of Earth System Sciences at UC Irvine. This broadcast is in preparation of an update of the melting data for Antarctica, as well as for Greenland. Eric Rignot is currently teaching at UC Irvine and is looking for grad students to join his research group in glaciology. A logo in the upper corner of the web page shows the map of Antarctica with several areas marked in red. They are beginning to awaken, and so should we. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Open the newest programs page and scroll down. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and free as podcast online. This is an unfunded program that depends entirely on donations by listeners. You can contact TUC Radio online at tucradio.org. The email is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
You can envision a future where people are actually putting power on the grid, benefiting from it, like in Denmark the other day, as you mentioned. These kind of more distributed forms of energy can also be more resilient, kind of like, thinking about how the internet is distributed. Power is distributed in the same ways. It's a lot harder to imagine blackouts and brownouts. It really means, sharing more financial resources.
That's the voice of Ben West from Tanker Free BC. On this week's show, we speak to Ben about transit referendums, increased tanker traffic, LNG plants, and of course climate change, where we've seen increased foggy and smoggy skies from raging forest fires around BC. So stay tuned.
We will swim 1,000 miles to shores of emerald isles with salmon spawning by the million, herring spawning by the billion. Gather with our pods again, the summer food, the summer friends, to raise our babies safe and free. We gather in the safe. loud cedars, the sons and the daughters, the rhythm of paddles caressing the water, the rhythm of paddles to come greet the orca. Remember the legend, the myth and the story, a long time ago when we witnessed the glory, the thousands and thousands of whales swimming free. The orcas come home to the great Salish Sea. Oh. I hear your song from many miles, your distant thoughts, your distant smiles. Today we fish in different bays. Tonight we meet again to play. Oh, hush, hear the swish of the boats on the water, the great sailing ships with sons and the daughters, the wind and the wood as it cuts through the water, the wind and the wood sailing out to the orca. Remember the legend, the myth and the story, a long time ago when we witnessed the glory, thousands and thousands of whales swimming free. The orcas come home to the great Salish Sea. Oh, around the sun, I saw the slaughter, smelled the blood, the water turning blue to brown, the metal ships, the screaming sound. I cannot hear your song today. The salmon. Tankers, the coal ports, the freighters, the deafening noise overtaking the water, the deafening noise overcoming the orca. Remember the legend, the myth and the story, a long time ago when we witnessed the glory, with thousands and thousands of whales swimming free. The orcas come home to the great Salish Sea. Oh, hush, hear the voice from both sides of the border, the rallies, the blockades, the brave sons and daughters, the people speak out for protecting the water. The people are rising to come save the orca.
The amazing song, The Great Salish Sea, by the same album for The Great Salish Sea by a local artist, Dana Lyons from Bellingham. Online, I have Ben West. He's the executive director of Tanker Free BC. Ben's been previously working for Forest Ethics Advocacy, the Wilderness Committee, where he distinguished himself as a community organizer. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm very good. Now, before we get to tanker traffic on the Burrard Inlet or the Salish Sea, we live in a region with major traffic congestion, and we're expected to grow by 1 million over the next 25 years. Yet people voted no overwhelmingly in a recent transit plebiscite. Your thoughts on the logic of having this kind of plebiscite for critical public infrastructure needs, and where do we go from here as far as transit improvements?
Well, I was pretty disappointed with the outcome of the transit referendum, although not particularly surprised given the kind of reaction that I got from folks in the community as we tried to advocate for transit improvements. I think many people were quite frustrated that there even was a referendum. In the midst of the referendum happening, there was a major provincial government announcement around highway expansion and spending on roads. Nobody was ever asked to vote on that. Many other major infrastructure projects, that's the case. When it comes to public transit, I think most people would agree that this is just a basic service of, of a municipal, provincial, federal government spending. So to be put in the position to choose between increased taxes and transit, just felt a bit staged, a little bit like, more of a public relations effort from a government who has really hung its hat on balancing a budget, knowing that it needs to spend money on transit, but yet not wanting to sign off on the expenditure. So where does this leave us? I think we're basically in the same position we were, except we're even more behind the eight ball. We, are faced with a lot of people moving to the region. That number might even be low. If we look at the potential impacts of extreme weather events and climate change and instability around the world, this is a very preferable destination for many people. And, we're going to need public transit, not just for the convenience of people, but the choices we make in terms of transit investment or transportation planning has huge implications for land use patterns, has huge implications for the future of this region. And I really fear that if we don't make the right decision soon, this could be very bad for the future of the agricultural land reserve and really have big negative impacts on our land use patterns and, really the sustainability of this region overall.
Now, I've been speaking with a lot of people since the no vote, and they're very disappointed also when they state that this is kind of the provincial government passing the buck when this should be in the Ministry of Transportation, just like BC Ferries should be governed and accountable directly to the province, and they seem to be putting these quasi-organizations between them and accountability. What do you think of just trashing TransLink and putting it back in the Ministry of Transportation?
Yeah, well, I think this was, in a lot of ways, a referendum on TransLink. I was a bit torn about my feelings about it. Yes, I wholeheartedly agree that it should be run by, the region's mayors. There should be an elected and appointed or accountable board. The steps that have been taken to sort of dismantle any government oversight at the local level has, really been a big step in the wrong direction, and I haven't liked, many of the decisions made by TransLink. I also felt like in some ways those who made this a referendum on TransLink were basically biting off their nose despite their face. It was, still the case that we needed transit badly, and, there's plenty of opportunity to unpack what was going on with TransLink. As much as I wasn't crazy about the question itself, the fact that we needed transit remained, and I thought we could sort of deal with some of the problems of the referendum, after all this was said and done. Taking a larger look at our tax infrastructure, the state of our crown corporations, what's private, what's public in this province, there's a lot of problems there. There's a lot to be looked at, and TransLink, I would put far from the top of the list of priorities, yet I would put transportation planning and action on climate change firmly at the top of that list.
Speaking about climate change, you're head of a group called Tanker Free BC. Now, Kinder Morgan currently has tankers that go through the Burrard Inlet, but your group is opposed to the pipeline expansion. Can you explain the scope of what this expansion would mean for tanker traffic through the Salish Sea?
Well, if Kinder Morgan has its way, not only will they build a new pipeline equivalent in size to the Enbridge pipeline along the route of the existing Trans Mountain pipeline, which was built over 60 years ago, largely for the sake of servicing the needs of British Columbians, but we would actually see an increase from the current state of somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 tankers a year up to well over 400 tankers a year. It's important to note that, that number was as low as 20, 25 tankers a year before Kinder Morgan bought the pipeline. We've already seen increases from a redistribution of what's going through that pipe, which has resulted in even more coming in by train and by truck. Kinder Morgan's intent is quite clear. They want to turn the west coast of Canada into a major gateway to the Asia Pacific. They want to take advantage of access to those markets. And right now, they're one of the only major points where tar sands oil is making its way onto international markets. And, of course, that's got huge implications for not only the safety of our region, but also for climate change overall.
Now, Ben, when I was doing some research for this interview, I came across a letter, an open letter on the internet addressing you from the Chamber of Shipping, and they had a few points, and I'll read a couple. They said improvements to design and construction have dramatically improved the safety over the last 25 years of tanker traffic, and now tankers are double-hauled, precision navigation. These are kind of commercials we see from Enbridge. How do you address these points that things are just much more safer now and the systems are better built?
Well, I mean, first of all, great. I mean, this is absolutely what we need for the existing traffic. It's not an argument for increasing traffic. Basically, it's a set of arguments that's fundamentally ecologically illiterate if you're living in the age of climate change. And to say that we're not going to spill as much oil into the inlet, and nobody can promise you that there will never be an oil spill, double-hulled tankers are no guarantee. All you have to do is Google the words double-hulled tanker oil spill, and you'll find plenty of examples of where that's happened. Nobody's immune to human error. Weather conditions can have huge impacts, and, simply putting an extra layer of metal between you and a major catastrophe is, far from a guarantee. But that being said, I'm quite happy that we've seen, increased focus on safety as a result of this conversation, and, the fact that, groups like that are writing me letters. Tells you that that they really do have a public relations problem on their hands because people are concerned about oil spills. But, the fact remains that, even if we didn't drop a drop of this oil into the inlet, the end result of this project going ahead as planned would be big increases in our contribution to global warming. And, we just simply live in an age where that's not acceptable and, would put us firmly on the wrong side of history, in my perspective.
Currently, out in Newfoundland, the premiers are meeting and talking about a Canada-wide energy strategy. And I think back to the last provincial election when Adrian Dix said that they wouldn't expand the Kinder Morgan. A lot of people say he paid a price for that. Can you address this fear that many people have that if we restrict our resource economy in some way, if we restrict resource exports, somehow our economy is going to tank? I guess the environment versus economy argument. Can you speak to that?
Well, a few things to unpack there. I mean, first, I don't think it's true that that Adrian Dix paid a price because of his Kinder Morgan statement. I think the way he dealt with that announcement left a lot to be desired. For anybody who remembers it, it was not the clearest announcement, and the next week was followed by explanations and follow-ups and statements that basically sounded anything like a firm commitment or a principled stance, and really looked a lot more like just kind of naked politics, an attempt to sort of win votes away from the Greens, who are very popular in ridings that were also important to the NDP. I felt like one of the biggest problems the NDP really had in that election was actually just a lack of vision. They really didn't roll out much of a platform. They didn't really talk about where job creation would come from under their government. For anybody who's following these issues closely, I mean, there's actually more people in the United States today working in solar power than working in coal. The number of jobs that are created by these pipelines, I mean, yes, there are jobs in the construction phase, but there's lots of different things that can be built that create jobs. And in the long-term operation phase, they actually don't create that many jobs. They create a tremendous amount of risk, and that risk is not only a risk to our ecology, but it's also a risk to our tourism business, to the brand of Vancouver or British Columbia as a beautiful destination location. That has implications for real estate, for whether capital is invested here from overseas, for any number of different businesses. And at the end of the day, the resource sector, to be fair, does create some good paying jobs for people upstream in Alberta. By and large, it's not a large portion of the economy of British Columbia at this point. The days where this was our major source of employment is behind us. There's more people working in construction, working in retail, working in high tech. We could go much further in that direction. What I would have loved to have seen from you know, from the NDP or really from any government is some focus on doing anything other than just basically pulling as much out of the ground as they can and selling it raw overseas. And, you know, it's a pretty unimaginative approach that we see from our current government. And, you know, and that ultimately really needs to change. There's many jurisdictions in Europe and elsewhere in the world where, you know, there's much more vision, where there's a plan that's not only responsible for the environment, but also creates many, many jobs that are the kind of jobs we can all be proud of. And, you know, I think Canadians are very capable and desirous of that kind of a role in the world and those kinds of jobs. I think it's a shame that this is so often framed as a competition between jobs and the environment, because truth be told, it's really about the power of, you know, some relatively wealthy individuals to maintain the status quo, you know, and that really has a negative impact on all of us.
Speaking of which, I just read this week in Denmark, they're creating 140% of their electrical power needs from wind power. So they have all the energy they need, plus they get to sell 40% of their excess power. Now, speaking of kind of going the wrong direction, Christy Clark this week has announced an historic agreement pinning our future on LNG, which is really fracking. She won't say the word fracking. Can you talk about fracking and the potential risk, long-term risks and disaster that this could result in?
Well, industry is always quick to point out that that fracking or hydraulic fracturing is a relatively old practice. I mean, we often talk about it as if it's brand new, and there is some truth to the fact that it's been happening for a long time, but never on the scale that we're seeing today. I mean, basically, this just means the injection of steam, chemicals, water deep underground to try to create fractures in shale formations or other underground rock formations to help us access the harder-to-access oil, gas, you know, that's underground. And basically, as we've run out of the easy-to-access kinds of oil and gas that just basically bubble to the surface, you know, when you strike a hole in the right place, you know, we've now gone to greater and greater lengths using more and more expensive technology, more and more groundwater, more and more chemicals. And they're basically doing, you know, dangerous experiments, you know, with rock formations that, you know, have been shown to result in earthquakes. You know, something like half of the chemicals that are pumped underground are well known to remain underground and will sit in aquifers. And, you know, of course, this is tied to things like people lighting their tap water on fire and farms that are located close to these operations. And, you know, any number of other potential problems that, you know, are the end result of doing stuff that has really not been done before on this scale, using chemicals, you know, that really shouldn't be anywhere close to agriculture or to human bodies, let alone wildlife, that, you know, will not only affect wildlife, but could work its way up the food chain and affect us ultimately. So, I mean, this is really, to a certain extent, a form of desperation. I mean, as we try to cling to the fossil fuel economy, we're going to greater and greater lengths, whether it be, you know, offshore oil drilling that goes deeper and deeper underwater or in the Arctic, you know, mountaintop removal, coal mining, where we're literally just blasting the tops off mountains, or fracking for oil and gas, which is, you know, yet another example of kind of the extremes that we'll go to try to, you know, uncover fossil energy. And, of course, with that, you know, these extremes comes also a much higher price for the extraction. And meanwhile, the price per unit of energy for renewables is only going down. So, I mean, not only is it dangerous, but it actually just doesn't make good economic terms in the long term, but actually even really in the relatively short term.
Yeah, I wish we could have direct democracy in some of these big decisions that seem so foolish instead of the decisions that are so vital to us, like having good transit. Now, we're going through a major drought in British Columbia. We have forest fires galore. I was on the Sunshine Coast a couple weeks ago, and I woke up and there was ash all over my car. It was pretty awful, and California is going through a historic drought. Can you talk about some of the opportunities with climate change to transition and not only will improve our planet, but improve our economy and lives?
Yeah, I mean, you know, definitely we are experiencing climate change, you know, and we're seeing it and feeling it in ways that many of us didn't even really anticipate. You know, I think for many of us, when we thought about climate change years ago, it wasn't necessarily a picture of, you know, Vancouver covered in ash and with smoke so thick that you couldn't, you know, see that far ahead of you. You know, the Vancouver in the last week or so, you know, looked like the pictures of Beijing that we all react to in terms of air quality. You know, and hopefully this is the kind of thing that leads people to wake up. I mean, everybody from the Pope to the Pentagon is talking about the need to transition off of fossil fuel dependence and the ability to get there. I, for one, am pretty excited about, you know, what that can mean, although, you know, I think it's important that we don't get too excited just about technology, because technology isn't going to do everything we need. You know, obviously we can't just shop our way to a more sustainable world. That being said, you know, moving away from internal combustion engines would be a very big step in the right direction. The technology to do so is already quite mature. Big steps are being taken in the direction towards the price of lithium-ion batteries going down. You know, we're seeing the price for, you know, not only solar and wind going down, but, you know, also geothermal is becoming more and more attractive and has huge potential. You know, no matter what we do, it needs to be done, you know, safely. And of course, all energy has a footprint, you know, through the power lines, the staging grounds, you know, and the projects themselves, you know, in terms of manufacturing and the deployment itself. That being said, you know, one of the things I find really promising about, you know, the future, you know, coming from more renewable sources is that, generally speaking, this means a more distributed form of energy production, which really can be quite empowering for local communities. Instead of being, you know, sort of the victims of what the oil and gas sector decides to do in their backyards, you know, you can envision a future where, you know, people are actually putting power on the grid, benefiting from it, like in Denmark the other day, as you mentioned. You know, these kind of more distributed forms of energy can also be more resilient, kind of like, you know, thinking about how the internet is distributed. You know, if power is distributed in the same ways, it's a lot harder to imagine blackouts and brownouts. And, you know, it really means, you know, sharing more financial resources. I mean, if that money is coming back to many more hands and not all concentrated in one place, you know, this really can mean serious benefits for communities, for individuals, you know, things like farmers who struggle to make ends meet in today's day and age. You know, we're already seeing farmers being some of the earliest adopters of solar and wind technology, you know, simply because it's a way to generate income. And for low-income people, you know, it's good to see this focus in the United States with a, you know, bill passed recently, which, or an initiative, I should say, coming from the president that, you know, really focuses on trying to make solar available to low-income people, low-income communities, to try to help reduce bills for folks, you know, who, you know, their energy bill is a big portion of their income. And really to make sure that that everybody's part of the conversation when it comes to the future of energy, not just those who can afford it.
Now, Ben, you are on a tour, tanker-free BC tour right now. Can you tell me about the tour and the response you're getting from people up and down the coast?
Well, we've been going up and down the coast in a solar-powered catamaran. It's a sailboat, you know, so it can, of course, you know, do the majority of the work just by the wind. But we've just installed a bank of solar panels on the top of this boat, like just on either side of the mast, facing up towards the sun, of course, and have banks of batteries in the pontoons on either side on this catamaran. It's got two Torquedo electric motors on it, which are about the equivalent of a 9.9 horsepower engine on the back of you know, either of the pontoons. Just outboard motors. You know, it's a pretty remarkable boat. And I mean, really the idea was to highlight the viability of some of this technology, to, you know, meet with people on public docks in various locations in the Lower Mainland and the Gulf Islands and Vancouver Island. And it's really just the beginning of a longer conversation, I think. But, you know, we're trying to reach beyond the so-called usual suspects who show up at rallies and you know, and really find folks, you know, who maybe we haven't been talking to, who are, you know, mariners or down at the public docks or walking around in, you know, the downtown area around the docks and just kind of engaging people in conversation. One of the really special parts of this tour has been traveling with a young musician by the name of Luke Wallace, who's been, you know, performing at the public docks, in public parks, and also at events that we've set up in various locations. So it is a pretty neat opportunity just to go out and be part of, you know, our beautiful coast and to really celebrate it. There's also going to be a lot of pictures and video that have already been captured and will continue to be that are going to be turned into a film of some kind that we're going to tour around with, along with a presentation to really share, you know, what our experience is like, the people that we talk to, and some of the tangible examples of solutions and alternatives, you know, that we're encountering in so many different places around the Salish Sea.
Thank you so much for the work you do, Ben, and spreading the word. And there's so many Vancouverites who want to transition and have a cleaner, healthier world. So any final thoughts before we let you go on citizen empowerment? And if someone's wondering, this problem's too big, where do I start? Any final thoughts on how people can engage?
Well, I mean, there's so many different ways to get involved, and everybody has different skills and different talents. You know, I would say that, you know, if you have to push yourself a little outside your comfort zone to get things done. One thing that I'm actually pretty excited about is an initiative we've started called the Great Climate Race, which is a fundraiser for local solar energy projects. The idea is a 10K and a 2K walk or run around Stanley Park on November 8th. And the idea is just to give people an opportunity to do something meaningful. I mean, everybody wants to do something for climate change. This is a way where you can raise money, you know, get involved in something very positive, very solutions oriented, and you know, real tangible. When you're finished the event, every step you've taken in it will have helped take us a little step closer to sustainability, and will help spread awareness about what's possible. So, you know, would love people to get involved in that. I think it's a very positive and easy place to start, and it's a great way to get to know other people who also want to do work for the better. And you know, I think that's really ultimately what it's going to take is us all meeting to each other and, you know, figuring out how to support each other so we can all get where we need to be.
Thank you so much, Ben, for the work you do and for spending a few moments with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources.